morning and welcome to the City of Palm Coast virtual City Council meeting. It is June 16, 2020. Pursuant to the Governor's executive order suspending all statutes that require a quorum to be present in person at local government public meetings or require a local government body to meet at a specific public place, the City may conduct meetings of its City Council without having a quorum of its members present physically or at any specific location, and utilizing communications media technology such as telephonic or video conferencing as provided by the Florida statutes. As mayor, pursuant to the authority granted to me by the city charter, I declared a public emergency on March 15, 2020 in response to COVID-19. Furthermore, pursuant to the powers and the governor's executive order, I suspended all city requirements that require a physical quorum to be present to conduct this meeting and authorized that this meeting be conducted by communications media technology under the city's state of emergency proclamation for virtual meetings executed on April 3, 2020. The city manager, pursuant to the authority granted him by the city's initial state of emergency for COVID-19, has closed City Hall to the public. Therefore, no member of the public will be allowed into the community wing of City Hall during this meeting. Notice that this meeting was going to be held by communication media technology and not at a physical location was posted at on the city's website at least 5 days ago. The notice provided that those members of the public needed reasonable accommodation to participate in the meeting could contact the city clerk for assistance by noon on Monday, June 15, 2020. Access to this meeting is being provided via live stream on the city's website at www.palmcoastgov.com and by calling 386-223-1690. Should you need technical assistance, please call 386-986-2391. Today is June 16, 2020, and it is 9 a.m. Please rise and join me in the Pledge Allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please.
Mayor Holland.
Here.
Vice Mayor Clufus.
Present.
Councilmember Branquino.
Here.
Councilmember Cuff. And Councilmember Howell. Is Mr. Howell on?
What's going on?
Councilmember Howell's not on yet, but
okay.
You can begin.
Okay, thank you. We'll now open it up to public participation. Any member of the public wishes to call in, you would now be able to call in at 386-223-1690. You will need to hit *9 to raise your hand to provide your comments. You will be acknowledged by hearing a message that you have been unmuted. Please state your name clearly for the record, and you will have 3 minutes to speak. You will not be disconnected from the meeting, but will be muted after your 3 minutes. All callers will have the opportunity to speak. Please be aware there may be a short pause as we switch to the next caller. We will now begin. Please state your name for the record, and your 3 minutes will begin. Thank you, Doug. We will close public comment. We will now move to agenda item number E1, which is the approval of the minutes of the city. Oh, sorry. Is there one? Okay. We will go back to public comment. Please take the first caller.
You are unmuted.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, okay, sorry. I had myself muted as well. This is Anna Maria Abad, Executive Officer at the Flagler Home Builders Association. I just wanted to make comment before you got to agenda item H5 regarding the increase for park impact fees.
This is a business meeting.
And I did write to council.
I'm sorry, Anna Maria. This is a business meeting, so all comments have to be addressed under that agenda item. So you need to wait, since this is an agenda item, to speak to that item during that time period.
Okay, my apologies.
No, that's okay. Thank you. Okay, we'll close public comment. We'll go to agenda item number E1, which is minutes of the City Council business meeting of June 2nd, 2020, minutes of the City Council workshop meeting of June 9th, 2020.
And I'll make a motion to approve those minutes.
Second.
I will second.
Roll call, please.
Vice Mayor Clufis?
Aye.
Councilmember Branquino?
Aye.
Councilmember Cuff?
Yes.
Councilmember Howell?
Yes.
And Mayor Holland?
Thank you, yes.
Passes 5-0, and just for the record, Councilmember Howell has joined the meeting.
We'll now move to agenda item number F2, which is a presentation on COVID-19 updates.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor, City Council. We do have an update this morning on our reopening plan, the state of COVID-19 in Florida. We have Chief Jerry Forte, Captain Thomas Asconi, and then Lauren Johnston as well to give us a status update on our parks and recreation openings and plans. Captain Asconi.
Good morning, Mayor. I'm just going to turn it over to Captain Asconi for his update. He's been working with the County Emergency Manager, Jonathan Lord, very closely for the last almost 4 months now, and we are in the opening phase of and very excited to move in that direction cautiously. But Captain Asconi will give the update.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council. Mr. City Manager, Tom Asconi, Fire Captain. In the state of Florida, we have 77,326 confirmed cases, of which there's 207 in Flagler County. And broken down into the zip code on the DOH website, we have 168 cases in Palm Coast. There has been 24 hospitalizations, and unfortunately, there has now been 5 fatalities. We have moved into phase 2 of the reopening plan of the state of Florida, and with doing such, so has the city. And we are slowly, safely, and methodically reopening the city to the public, to our citizens, and to our staff. Yesterday, June 15th, we opened summer camp to our citizens to give the kids a place to go and reconnect with friends. We've also reopened City Hall to staff only, where we are ensuring the safety and the making sure that we have all the things in place and the procedures to welcome the citizens back in early July. We still encourage everybody to wear masks when out in public, ensure that we have the 6-foot social distancing. And those are the things that we have done for phase 2 at this part. Thank you.
Council, any questions or comments before Lauren begins her presentation for either Chief Forte or Captain Asconi?
Not this time. We're in good hands.
Doug, do you see anyone? Who is that? No, I was going to do we have any council? That's okay. Okay, thank you. Okay.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Lauren Johnson, Director of Parks and Recreation. Just wanted to provide you with a brief update on our reopening success through COVID-19. On Monday, May 4th, we opened parks, certain parks and trails and pedestrian paths. And they were open to the public during limited hours of 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. On Monday, May 18th, we opened James Holland Park, Belterre Park, Seminole Woods Park, tennis courts, and they were open to the public with reduced hours to 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And on May 18th, we also opened up the Palm Harbor Golf Course and the Palm Coast Tennis Center. On Saturday, June 6th, parks opened and resumed normal operations, including playgrounds, sports fields, and Sports Alliance members approved guidelines. And on Monday, May 8th, basketball courts, volleyball courts, and racquetball courts were open to the public and resumed normal hours. It's been about a year since I came to council with an update on our Sports Alliance. The following organizations used our sports field for the winter-spring season. We had Mad Dogs with 350 flag football participants, Royal Palm Soccer Club with 30 participants, Palm Coast Little League with 540 participants, the Adult Soccer League with 80 participants, Florida Elite Soccer with 480 participants, and Palm Coast Soccer with 27 participants. The Flagler Swap organization, which is actually a future problem solver team that is represented from Matanzas High School, Indian Trails Middle School, and FPC. They are a group that collects gently used sports equipment for those kids who quickly outgrow their sporting equipment, and they give it to those who are less fortunate and not able to buy new equipment every year. They came and spoke to the Sports Alliance members at the last two meetings, asking for donations and potential storage space for any items that were collected. With our Sports Alliance members, we as Palm Coast Parks and Recreation developed new bylaws for Sports Alliance membership. We're working on a streamlined and more efficient process for potential organizations to become a Sports Alliance member. We've continued to build and have an excellent working relationship with Flagler County Parks Department, and our next scheduled Sports Alliance member meeting will be next month in July. So through Sports Alliance and COVID-19, our Palm Coast Parks and Recreation Department staff reached out to Sports Alliance members on May 19th and asked them to supply a set of guidelines for reopening their respective sports. The criteria that we evaluated them on for an approved permit to utilize our fields must have included a social distancing procedure, a sanitation process, a temperature and wellness screen, and certain capacity requirements in line with the governor's step-by-step reopening procedure. These guidelines strictly enforce player, coaches, and spectator safety. Sports fields were open on Saturday, June 6th to Florida Elite Soccer and Palm Coast Little League, and they practiced on that day, and I've attached some pictures for your viewing. On this slide is Florida Elite Soccer, and the next slide is Palm Coast Little League. Both organizations are very happy to get back on the fields. A part of our Sports Alliance also has our sports tournaments. Many of our tournaments were rescheduled due to COVID-19, but this is a listing of our upcoming schedule. Our district tournaments, as well as state tournaments, and some national championships that include spring of 2021. And I've included the Palm Coast Little League state tournament for this summer as well. The Palm Coast Tennis Center, we are practicing our social distancing, and we've opened up phase one during staggered court times, and now during phase two, we have the facility open for all courts of play. We do have a plexiglass installed, and staff are wearing their masks. At this time, we're about 85% capacity, with our morning usage being the most popular. In our evening hours, we just keep getting rained out for some reason. Those afternoon thunderstorms keep rolling in. At the Palm Harbor Golf Course, we had 883 rounds sold in the first week. During our phase one requirements, we were doing 15-minute tee times intervals. And then now during phase two, we are doing 12 minutes. And all of the carts are sanitized upon return. We are still doing one cart per person, or if a group may so choose because they live in the same household, we will accommodate two people per cart. Next is our Palm Coast Community Center. The building felt alive yesterday with the start of summer camp. We worked with the Flagler County Sheriff's Office and our wonderful Public Works Department to develop a new traffic operations plan to allow a new drop-off and a pickup procedure where the parent never has to get out of the car, and the building and playground are completely closed to the public. The only people allowed inside the community center are summer camp participants and staff. And again, this our new traffic pattern and some of our signage that we have posted around the facility. And finally, we are very happy to have, we had 67 kids enrolled in camp this week in grades between kindergarten and seventh grade. 16 of those 67 were City of Palm Coast employee children, and 20 of them were CDGB scholarship recipient children. We have, you know, they love to play on our dry erase boards, and the kids are playing gaga ball in one of the bigger rooms. So that concludes the presentation. Is there any questions?
Counsel, any questions for Lauren at this time?
Not at this time.
I just have one question, Lauren. I know I've seen the emails as far as a senior citizen population utilizing the community center for activities that they've become accustomed to. I know they've been really amongst the most vulnerable population that's been identified for COVID, and they've been separated for a long time. I wonder about the socialization. Has there been any thought process around perhaps trying to accommodate, like, Pinnacle group for any other facility that we have closed down that they can go in and use separately so they're not necessarily placed in an area that is going to put them at risk? I know, like, hospitals are doing this with at-high-risk patients. They're going into back areas of the hospital and being brought in back areas. And I know we have other facilities that have been closed, and I don't know what size location they need, or I don't know if we can work with the Green Lion or something, but I also am concerned about those that have been shut in that are really in need of some socialization to get some normalcy back to get around their friends as well. And I don't know if that's possible or not, but I thought I would at least ask.
Sure, Mayor. I can reach out to the Pinnacle Club and see just what size requirements, and then look around within our city resources and see if we have any availability. I know the governor still has the restrictions on the vulnerable. I'm working closely with the recreation director of the city of Port Orange, and they're looking at reopening guidelines for their senior centers, and we're hoping to mirror that same guidance. But it's a work in progress, and I will look into some resources that we can look to accommodate for those smaller groups.
I would ask Matt and the chief that. I mean, so is the governor's order just to keep them completely away? Is that it?
So Rick continues to recommend that they remain isolated, the vulnerable populations. And to your point, we are examining unused space. So every year there's a local group that provides tax assistance to anyone, but specifically to the senior groups. We have identified and are using the classroom at the Frida Zamba swimming pool because there is no one else there. That's a space that we can isolate, we can sanitize, we can clean. They've submitted a very detailed schedule of how they will schedule clients with intervals to clean. So we will continue to your point, to council's point, to look at how we can integrate quickly and find those opportunities to get all of our populations back to normalcy.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't want to put them at risk, but they've been very lovely, but they continue to reach out in an effort to just understand when they can resume some sort of activity.
Just to add, when we started looking at the opening of phases of phase two and how we entered into phase one, we also looked at when we started seeing the changes regionally on how the COVID impact is affecting our most vulnerable group. We're taking this into account. I think Lauren's group is doing a wonderful job in figuring out how the processes are going to be working. Most recent articles that are coming out, even out of Orange County, they're seeing a very large resurgence. So I think her approach to allowing the seniors to come back is both wise and protective of them during this process. And if we can keep that distancing going, I think we could be on the forefront of coming up with new ways of integrating seniors into our programs, as well as providing them with the protection that they're going to need.
Mayor, if I could add as well, there's the thing that I keep on stressing to our staff and it is COVID-19 is still heavily in our community and in our state. We're seeing the numbers rise every day on our state levels, but they're not rising in our community. And that's because of the things, the safety precautions that we put forth, and that's what's keeping our numbers down. It's prudent that we operate, move slowly and methodically to reopen this, reopen our activities and our activities to our citizens to ensure their safety.
No, I completely agree. But again, I've watched other communities around the world try to address their senior population and find a way to keep them safe and also allow them some type of activity. I've seen places in other countries where they've scheduled hours for walking for their seniors outside of hours from the less at-risk population. So I'm just asking for maybe a little bit of creativity plugged in to where we address this in a very safe manner. But I also do believe socialization is critical during these times. A lot of our at-risk population don't always have family members that are here. They're very reliant on their neighbors and things like that. So if there's a way, I just would like for us to at least maybe try to look at it. I've been reading a lot about, how they're trying to reacclimate into the communities with keeping them safe. So, but I am very supportive of our first responders approach. I take your recommendations very seriously. I don't want to veer from those recommendations. I just thought I would offer that as maybe some type of thought process if there's a way to do that.
Yes, ma'am.
And I just also want to address and thank Lauren and her team because, working with the Sports Alliance, this is an organization that was set up and sort of reinvigorated under Lauren's leadership in a way that's been very collaborative with a lot of our active sports organizations that utilize our amenities. And so thank you, Lauren, for you and your team for really making sure that these families are kept safe with this reopening strategy, that there are guidelines. And then thank you to the organizations that have stepped up and really demonstrated that the families of those organizations matter to them, this community matters to them, and they want to be part of the solution. So I'm very appreciative of your effort and your work, and I'm just very proud of everyone throughout this response of COVID. We have done an exceptional job in our response, and it is due in part to being consistent, right, and being steady and making sure we're listening to the health professionals. So we're going to keep going. We're not going to let up on this, and we do really need to heed the warnings and the advice of the professionals giving those. So thank you, Chief Forte and Captain Ascone, for your continued effort on this, and thank you, Matt, for leading the whole team. We'll now move to agenda item number G, which is an ordinance on second read. So we don't hear from you that often these days, Bill.
No,
this is on you.
I get three times today. Open my big trap. So let me read the title to this first one, which is the temporary moratorium. So here we go. This is an ordinance of the City of Palm Coast, Florida, establishing a temporary moratorium on the review and consideration of applications for approval of small box discount stores throughout all of Palm Coast. This ordinance requires the planning and Land Development Regulation Board to initiate a review of the city's comprehensive plan and land development regulations regarding small box discount stores and to report to the city council regarding its recommendations. It provides for purpose and intent for accepted development. It provides for the duration of the moratorium, for one possible time extension, for administrative remedy to assert vested rights, and for severability, non-codification, and for an effective date. And this is the second reading, Mayor, Council.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Honorable Mayor, City Council. We're here today because, as Bill mentioned, we had a first reading and we never had a second reading. Part of that was due to the COVID shutdown. We shut down all non-essential meetings at that point, which included the Planning Land Use Board. So today we have Jason DiLorenzo to present, not only to talk about this particular piece of legislation, but to present, as was requested by Council of Staff, a very specific timeline, date certains, and a plan and strategy to move this to a decision point for the community, for the PLDRB. So with that, I'd ask Jason if you could go ahead and bring us up to speed on where we're at, why we're here, and the specific timeline to move, plan to move ahead.
Good morning, Mayor, City Council. As was already stated, yes, this is the second reading of the temporary moratorium for small box discount stores. The ordinance was originally on the agenda for March the 17th, which was canceled due to public concerns over COVID-19. And now it's necessary for us to bring this back to place the ordinance in the correct legislative posture. With us now, with the state now being in recovery phase two, we are planning to have our first in-person planning board meeting on July the 15th. And based on the feedback that you provided us at your March the 10th workshop, we're prepared to bring a proposed ordinance to that meeting for consideration. And the proposed ordinance removes small box discount stores from neighborhood commercial as a permitted use and provides a special exception requirement when the proposed location is within 500 feet of residential uses. The latter will provide an opportunity for additional public input when a small box retailer wishes to locate near homes. As far as the timeline, like I said, we'll be taking this to the PLDRB on July the 15th in a few weeks, and then bring it to you for first consideration on August the 4th and second reading on August the 16th.
Thank you. Council, any questions or comments on this agenda item at this time?
Not at this specific time.
Councilmember Howell.
You know, shortly after we raised this issue, I was getting results back from the survey or the letters that we went out to various members of the National Business Aviation Association. And while this thing was still a news item, I had two companies that I had been working with that when they saw that, they withdrew any interest in our county and city. And, you know, that really kind of put big questions in my mind with regards to trying to get some of these big corporations, because we don't have that business here, as you well know. And it, these companies are aerospace, they're clean, and they were going to start at a minimum wage of $60,000, and we're talking anywhere from 250 to 350 employees. But they just felt that the decision to do this was heavy-handed, and they don't want to come into a community like that. Now, that being said, I've been dealing with some high executives in NASA to also bring in some aerospace and other type industries to support the goings-on at the Kennedy Space Center. But this is just an albatross around our neck, and I don't support it. I think it's lived its usefulness. We don't have any big box stores or small box stores on the agenda right now, and I don't think it's needed. That's my opinion.
Council, any other comments or questions? Council Member Cuff, and then we'll.
Yes, Madam Mayor. I just had a question for staff. I agree we need to get this wrapped up one way or the other. We've already effectively had our moratorium thanks to COVID-19. And if the staff has recommendations that they want to put before the planning board that they want us to consider, I have no problem considering those in the right legislative cycle. But I think we need to end any discussion of a moratorium. I mean, if we decide we need some additional land development type regulation for this particular use, I think we can do that without the stigma that some people see attached to a moratorium targeting a particular type of business. So I guess what my question then is to Mr. Reichman or to Mr. DiLorenzo is, we can move forward with the planning board reviewing this. It can be brought back to us to vote up or down on additional regulations, but is that necessarily tied into a moratorium, or can we just drop the moratorium and just move on with this as a legislative item for our consideration on the land development code?
Mayor, Council, yes. The moratorium, as you see, provides for a time frame of 150 days. This is on page 5 of 6, and it's that begins to run from the effective date. The effective date is immediately upon passage. So if this council were to vote in favor of the second reading of this ordinance today, this moratorium would be enacted and it would extend for 150 days. The purpose of this is stated in the legislative and administrative findings, which were incorporated into it, are to allow a status quo, as I'm sure Mr. Councilmember Cuff understands and the council understands, is just to keep things as they are during that period of time. As Mr. DiLorenzo indicated, we have got this teed up for PLDRB at its next meeting, which will be a live meeting, which will be July 15th. I do not know the exact dates. I'll defer to Mr. DiLorenzo as far as when those regulations would come back to council, but I would anticipate it would be in towards the end of July, and potentially, if it gets that far, for second reading in early August. And the answer to your question, Councilmember Cuff, is that while a moratorium for this type of matter is not unusual, it is not legally required. The council can choose today to not impose a moratorium. Now, the impact of that is that during that period of time from today going forward until there would be additional limitations or regulations imposed by future legislation on what we're calling small box discount stores, the current land development code would apply to any applications received for those types of developments, commercial developments in the city of Palm Coast.
And let me just add, I mean, I think, you know, Bob, your question or point, you know, we had sort of an interruption throughout this, and it's COVID-19. So this matter would have been voted on and approved within the time frame originally established if the planning board was allowed to meet. They were not. The governor's executive order obviously stopped a lot of progression on legislative matters, including in Tallahassee. They have yet to meet. So I don't see this as necessarily, that this has been stalled or put on the back burner on, without any thought or conversation. It's just the fact that we were in the midst of a global pandemic, which precluded us from moving forward.
I just asked some about this, but I'll save it for my comments at the end.
Vice Mayor Clufus.
Yes. Hey, good morning, everyone. A couple points. First, I'd just like to challenge Jack's assessment that this somehow negatively impacted the persona of our local community. If a company is going to bring 250 jobs, I find it highly unlikely that they're going to be looking for a pocket parcel inside or near residential areas. So I don't I don't endorse that, and I challenge Jack to provide me information that you can directly tie to companies being committed to moving here that are no longer going to be here. Second, I think it's very important that we emphasize the fact that this is going to create an opportunity for our residents that are near proximity to these potential small box stores to be able to voice their opinion before that before they're placed inside of their community. We understand that there's a very diverse cross-section of Palm Coast that either feels adamantly one way or another about this topic. We cannot just lump this all together and say that this is a moratorium on small box stores. What it really is we are just giving ourselves time to allow the legislation to be put in place that will give a voice to the people so that they can give their perspective on whether or not they want a small box store near them. I don't want this narrative to be generated that this is going to cause 250 jobs for $60,000 or more not to move to Palm Coast, because I don't believe that. And I want to publicly state that I'm challenging you, Councilmember Howell, to prove to me that that's the truth, because I'm not going to allow that narrative to be generated. We're trying to allow our residents input into this process so that they can voice their opinion on whether they support a small box store in their community or not. And that's why I totally am in favor of this, because we are going to give residents more power and more input into this process, which is a good thing. Thank you.
Councilmember Howell, I would like to give you a moment to respond to Council Vice Mayor Klufas's comments, since they were directed at you.
Well, I'm not going to belabor the fact. I know the companies I talk to. Nick, this is a campaign ploy that you're running right now. Cut the nonsense.
Thank you.
I tell you how it's going. This is what happened to these companies. They feel that our city is heavy-handed, and they just don't like this. That's the bottom line.
Can you
know, we can talk about this some other time, some other place, but not while you're campaigning. I don't want to make this a big issue. Sorry, buddy. That's the way I feel.
Yeah.
So you can't.
Go ahead, Nick. I don't want to go it with a back and forth. I don't think this is the appropriate, but I did want to give the moment, and Nick, I'll give you that final response, please.
No, understood, and my challenge still remains for you, actually, to put me in touch with one of these companies that is not going to bring 250 jobs and $60,000 to this community. That's outlandish. They wouldn't be in these pocket parcels. I look forward to your response. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Brinkley, now.
This is exactly what I wanted to speak at the end, but due to the fact this is proper at this time, with all fairness to Jack Owl, I would say that maybe Jack could get together with a city manager and come up with a name of those companies, so maybe we all together could still salvage those 260 jobs if they were ready, or any other things. We could all together make either a letter or meeting with personal and help Jack to bring those jobs. Maybe we didn't lose them yet. I don't know. But I think maybe the city manager ought to talk with Jack Owl, and he'll tell you, I'm pretty sure he'll tell you who those companies are, and we all together could work on those. Right? That was basically what I was going to say at the end, but I've said it now. I think that was proper. Thank you.
Okay. And I'd like to state on the record as well that, again, to Vice Mayor Klufas's point, and with all due respect, I do not believe that Vice Mayor Klufas's point is politically motivated. I think from the very beginning, he has stated his position very clearly. That this was about where these small box stores are to be located in our city, what makes sense as we grow and plan for the future, that they are existing and continuing to grow as an industry, and it's a conversation we should be having as an elected body. That is all I've heard from the very beginning. And with that, I'm pleased that we've had these conversations both in workshops and public meetings as far as what the council guided staff to do. What we asked for was to please make sure they are located appropriately, and if indeed they are being proposed in residential neighborhoods that could have an impact on traffic, that could have an impact on quality of life, that could have an impact on a number of other things that causes the residents to have serious concerns, that this is a vehicle that would give them a way to directly communicate that in a process that is set up by the state legislature and handed down to us in official capacity. So I see nothing more than that by this conversation. Unfortunately, it had to be sidetracked due to COVID-19. Nothing more than that. This is plain and simple. The fact of the matter is, if we do have companies of interest, I would hope that any elected official would reach out and communicate and coordinate with our city administration in an effort to make sure they have all the resources available to them to make an informed, good decision. That's how this process should work. None of us go out there and court a company in isolation without a coordinated effort amongst many team members that are absolutely open to them. So, you know, this right now is a conversation about an ordinance that's in front of us that keeps this dialogue moving forward and allows it to go through an official process through our planning board for them to debate it, to discuss it, to have public input, and then be brought back to this council in a likewise manner to have public input, a public dialogue of exchange, and ideas and concepts, and then we make the ultimate decision. And to Vice Mayor Kloofus's point, this gives a greater emphasis on the public that has concerns about where they are located in residential areas. This is not to do away with small box stores in the city of Palm Coast. So whatever narrative that has been placed out there, that's just not based in reality. This is where it's to be located, realistically, appropriately. Again, that doesn't impede on noise, traffic, those sorts of things that we know retail areas bring to the equation, and that's all this discussion has been from the very beginning. Okay, we will open it up to the public. Any member of the public wish to make public comment on this agenda item, please call in at 386-223-1690.
Hi, Anna Maria Abad, on the moratorium. I think this is so deeply a PR issue as far as the wording temporary moratorium. The wording itself sounds as though you want to put a stop to everything, when the reality of what it is precisely what Mayor Holland and Vice Mayor Kloofus just stated, it's about getting public input from the citizens here in Palm Coast. And I think that when approaching businesses, and it's framed at like that as what it truly is, we are getting public input from the people who live here, I think that tells a much different story about how the government takes care of the residents here instead of making it look like the government stomps on things. And I know that there is a preface of being not business friendly in the past, and I think that's what makes this a hot button issue. But getting input from residents is so, so vital. So I think when speaking with businesses that it's framed correctly and told what it actually is versus just temporary moratorium, that dealings would go much smoother. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Doug, are there any other callers? To the caller's comment, I completely agree. Unfortunately, when we deal with government and rules and guidelines that we have to abide by when we're making these decisions, there is a vehicle, whether the word moratorium has a positive connotation or negative, I probably more negative than not. So I think we probably have to do a really good job of communicating this to the residents. So Matt, if you would make sure that Tyler and his team are engaged and have a process in which to do that to do different entities, I think that would be very helpful as we go through this. Thank you. And I appreciate the comments very much. Okay, Council, we will take it back to the Council, and I will entertain a motion.
I'll make the motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Just for the record, it's motion for approval of the moratorium for the ordinance.
Just want to clarify. Yes, thank you.
Temporary moratorium.
Yes,
thank you.
Virginia, roll.
I'm sorry.
Virginia, roll call, please.
Vice Mayor Clufus.
Aye.
Councilmember Brinquino.
Aye.
Councilmember Cuff.
Yes.
Councilmember Howell.
No.
And Mayor Holland.
Yes.
Mayor, this motion passes 4-1.
Thank you. Agenda item number H, 4 is another ordinance. Mr. Reichman.
Here we go. Mayor, Council, this is an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Palm Coast, Florida, amending Chapter 29 Impact Fees, Article 4, Fire and Rescue System Impact Fee. This is amending Sections 29-102, Adoption of Impact Fee Formula, 29-103, Imposition and Amount of Fire and Rescue Impact Fee credits for Donation, Section 29-104, Use of Proceeds, Section 29-107, Changes of Size and Use Mixed Uses, and Section 29-112, Review Requirements, Code of Ordinances of the City of Palm Coast. This ordinance provides for applicability, severability, codification, conflicts, and provides for an effective date, Mayor.
Did you want to introduce
Absolutely. This? Sorry. Thank you, Honorable Mayor, City Council. So we are here today to discuss the proposed fire impact fee. Fire impact fees are rooted in the well-established principle that new growth should pay the proportional share of fiscal impacts to continue to deliver the same level of service to the community. This is a well-established practice that helps us better balance the tax burden and distribute those costs among new residents and keep taxes increases to a minimum here in our community. And that's what this proposal is talking about, is fire impact fees to continue to deliver a level of service that was established by City Council almost 18 years ago to continue to provide fire life safety in our community. So with that, I think part of this process, which is my fault, we were remiss in providing last time, was sort of the background as to what this fire impact fee, the very strategic purpose, all the work that went into this. What I've asked this morning is for Chief Forte to give us a short presentation explaining our current level of service, explaining why the innovations that have come. This is not the same recycled approach where we're going to go build these mega structures. This is a very methodical, very well-reasoned approach to continue to deliver outstanding service to our community at the bare minimum cost and fairly distributing those costs again to new development. So with that, Jerry, if you would not mind giving us the background and context, that would be fantastic.
Thank you, Mr. Morton. Mayor, Council, Jerry Forte, presenting on behalf of FIRE. I'm going to share my screen about the presentation. And please let me know if it's coming up. Can you all see that?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so to begin with, in order to get to the fire impact fee report, we had to do a few things. One of them is create the 10-year plan, which has been vetted through council. We also did a station location study, which was reviewed by council, and now we're going to get a little bit more in depth in why are we doing an impact fee over the life of the organization for the next 15 years or so. And if we're going to have an impact fee, what are the things that are going to be tangibles that have to be purchased over that lifetime that we'll experience? So it incorporates the fire services industry methodology for response times, the population, travel distances, and the current fire station capabilities when all calls are considered throughout the city. The report was analyzed using projected response times, using GIS data, basically saying if we had a station in our current locations, what our response times would be, and those were codified with the actual data that we pulled from our CAD system just to verify that if we can project where our current stations are, we can also predict if we put a station somewhere the benefit that that would have. We assessed the call volume for all current Palm Coast stations with the assistance of our planning department, and we looked at the projected future growth of where things are going to be, and we'll cover that in a little bit in the program. So a little history. In 2002, the Palm Coast City Council has established performance goals for the emergency response of the Palm Coast Fire Department. This was shortly after we were part of the new city, and we were the first department taken over. And their goal was 5 minutes or less, 85% of the time, citywide. And that includes a two-minute tone-out to roll-out response to getting on the truck. In 2010, through the matrix study, we did two studies in 04 and in 2010. The 2010 report, we changed it to a six-minute response time, or 1 minute out the door, 6 minute down the road. And again, that was also for a seven-minute response time from the time we were toned out. In 2010, when that was created, the fire department was able to meet the city council goals because most of the population density was close to where the fire stations were. And during that period of time, we actually were hitting those marks. Today, we're averaging 73 to 76% of the time we're there, 7 minutes or less, which is not a direct reflection. It's just the matter of the amount of population and density that has grown into the community, and it's grown further away from the station normal response area. So why is the response time important? This is a critical area. We're looking for 7 minutes represented by the green line. The probability for most vulnerable factors in delivering emergency service is getting there in a timely manner. If we look at the fire propagation in a structure, we look at anything after 12 minutes is going to involve a room fully involved with fire, or if it's in the room, it's going to spread throughout the entire house at that 12-minute mark. You can see at the 7-minute mark here that it's a critical time. It's just before it's going to get heated enough to flash a room or create extensive heat in that house. So the quicker we get there, the better off, and why we had the council establish those timelines. In addition to the fire component, there's the medical component. Anytime after 7 minutes of a cardiac arrest, the likelihood of recovery from that is between 30 and 40%. And if we're there after 7 minutes, your chances of survival have seriously decreased. So this is why it's the response time is a critical component in configuring the station locations. The emergency response totals are another component. We know for sure that in 2018, we ran just over 10,000 calls. 2019, it was 10,500. Although these projections might be high for 2020, we won't know exactly what those numbers are going to be until the end of the year. But we know our responses for the community were 10,500. We also know that the population is going to be somewhere around 90,000, possibly 92,000. And I tell you these two numbers, they're of critical importance. When you take the call volume and you divide it by the community's population, you come up with a utilization number of 12%. It's actually 11.7. But if you figure 12% of the population uses our services every year, that can help you when you're starting to plan out your communities are growing and how many calls will impact your community every time 1,000 people come to town. So if 1,000 people are coming to town, you're looking at 120 calls per year that will be generated by the increase in population. That's an important number that we'll get into in just a little while. So how far is the demand of growth in the city? This is the last 6 years that we were able to acquire data from the planning department. And we can see that there's an increase in permitting as it's been going on in the last couple of years. Specifically, we went from 880 permits up to 1,300 permits in the same amount of time. So it's evident that we are growing and the permits are still being pulled. So we also look at what the capacity is. We've got two fire stations that make up 55% of our community response to all calls. So Station 21, that's the one by Coles, and Station 25 down by Royal Palms, make up the lion's share of the calls, over 50%. So we know those two stations are busy. We also know that there's a lot of capacity in Station 23 in the north end. So Colonel Howell asked a couple of months ago about the apartments coming in the north end of Belterra, Matanzas, and we spoke about, do we have enough response there? We know that we can actually increase that station's response by 500 calls before we even have to consider capacity. So as we're starting to add apartments or add subdivisions, we're building that capacity into that station, and I don't have a lot of concern because there's still a lot of calls that can still be run. They're under about 1,000 calls a year. When it gets around 1,800 or 2,000 calls a year, that's when I start to get a little bit of nervous about how many calls they're running. Station 21 is in the center of the city, the heart of the city. They're running 2,600 calls a year and 2,200 respectively at Station 25. So we look at capacity over the lifetime of the station on how well it's operating and where the calls are going. So even if we go into the future development of a DRI such as Palm Coast Park, we know that we can still increase this station by at least 500 calls without having to make any adjustments to the operation. So we did a gap analysis after all the data was collected, and we found Seminole Woods resulting from one of the biggest problems, and this is no reflection on the wonderful people that operate out of Station 92 in the county. They service Seminole Woods, but the biggest challenge that they have is not how they respond, it's distance. It's completely distance on how they have to get to the south end of Seminole Woods. And that data was collected, and we figured out how long it takes to get to the south end. Part of our own response would be Whiteview Parkway, which is kind of in a really bad spot between Station 21 by Coles and Station 25 by Royal Palms. This pocket of purple is experiencing 8 to 9 minute response times, which when we planned it out in 2004, and we developed where the station locations were going to be, we could predict then that this area would gain in popularity. People would build there. They would start to settle there. And just by the sheer density of the growth in there is calling more calls in this area than what we've planned before. So now it's time that we start to look to address those areas. So south of State Road 100, we've identified that the very south end, just because of distance from Station 92, we're starting to see calls in the 9 to 12 minute mark, and sometimes well over 12 minutes as well. And again, this is no reflection on the staff at 92. This has everything to do with geometry and the logistics of where the station is in distance and miles. I don't think there's any fire department on the planet that can actually get there in a less amount of time of what they're trying to get there. It is just when that station was occupied back in the early 2000s, we didn't have a lot of call volume at the south end of Seminole Woods. In the nearly 2 decades that we've been monitoring this, we're at the point now where we're starting to see a large amount of calls outside of our scope of 7 minutes or less. Similarly to the same area of Whiteview, we've identified the furthest part as being in high usage between 8 to 10 minutes. We don't see a whole lot of purple color there in the 12 minute, but we know that this has, by prediction, is going to be one of our problem areas, which is also part of what our solution is going to be. So looking at the future in our current platted area, we have the traffic analysis zones, or the TAS zones, that have been marked out. And we know in Seminole Woods, we're expecting about 4,000 buildable lots that are ready to go today to be built upon in south end of Seminole Woods and Belterre Boulevard. So we have to predict and we have to plan for that. So if there's 4,000 lots and there's 2.3 people living per lot, the call volumes are going to go up. We also have to look at Whiteview, and if there's 2,000 available TAS lots that are ready to be built on today, they're already in the system, we expect an increase in call volume. And by doing the calculations, we know that Whiteview will eventually get at least 500 more calls per year when it gets further closer to build out, and we know Seminole Woods and South Belterre should anticipate well over 1,000 calls per year when it gets closer to the build out. So these are the things that we have to also calculate and plan for in the future. So our recommendations are for a single fire station, standard station, with a traditional 3 bays, 9 firefighters over 3 shift, a Class A pumper. You're looking at the cost for that being $4.5 million for the station, $550,000 for the truck and some equipment, and that would be paid through fire impact fees, not ad valorem tax. Staffing would be around $700,000 a year, and that's an unfortunate recurring cost that we're going to have to absorb into the normal operations. For the Whiteview area, we're looking at a different kind of concept. We also know that that area receives most of its calls between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. And the consideration of what we're looking for is to have a smaller station that's going to run between the peak hours, Monday to Friday, which we've established is our peak times. Saturdays and Sundays are low volume. Monday through Fridays are the peak volumes. Between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. is our high volume of calls in that area. So we can actually put a smaller station with two half bays, two firefighters during peak hours, with a mini attack truck. That cost is $1 million for the station, just over a little quarter of $1 million for the mini attack truck, and that would be paid through impact fees. And the $136,000 reoccurring cost for salaries, that would cover 72% of the calls, and we estimated that station, if it opened up, would run about 800 calls per year. So we would have a tremendous impact on the call response time in that one zone, and we can actually put this station in for 25% of the cost of an actual fire station. In our opinion, and we've done some research, we don't need to put a full-scale fire station in an area when we can identify when the peak times are, and we can utilize this for the next 15 years until we know there's further development going to happen on the other side of US 1. We also considered counterpart to Station 26 on Seminole Woods, the area of Belterre Boulevard at the south end. We've identified that area as having some response challenges. This could be eliminated by creative design with infrastructure flow if we can get with the builder and the designer and have a pass-through from Citation over to Belterre Boulevard. We can actually eliminate this building from our planning and would save us roughly about $1.5 million for equipment and fire station costs for building. Another way of looking at the way we're being innovative and thinking outside our norm is working on Colbert Lane. Right now, the call volume going to Grand Haven is low. It's on the 300 to 350 range, and it varies. We're actually working with Fire Station 22 off of Clubhouse and Fire Station 11, which is Flagler Beach. They both co-share Colbert Lane. Flagler Beach goes up to the north side of Palm Coast Plantation. Station 22 comes down to the midpoint of Grand Haven. So we've already begun joint operations and share that location because of the way we send our vehicles out through automatic vehicle locations. Our proposal would be to create a joint facility funded through the Palm Coast impact fee that we build it within the city at the very south end of our jurisdiction. We can utilize staffing from Flagler Beach Fire Department and Palm Coast to offset our recurring budgetary costs. And if we go at the south end of Palm Coast on Roberts Road, we can actually cover everything from 100 up to Palm Coast Parkway, anything south on John Anderson to the Ormond Beach border. This is going to require additional fire stations. I don't see the need to put two fire stations then in there, and by working with our partners, both at Flagler Beach and the county, I believe we can come up with a consensus of just establishing one fire station that will be responsible for both the corridor south on John Anderson and north up Colbert Lane. We are designing all of our fire stations to accommodate for a transport ambulance and two county firefighters so that they can be part of our system. That's already built in, and we're already working well with Flagler Beach on developing a relationship with them to continue that into the future. Palm Coast Park is also well off, 10 years off. Station 23, like I said earlier, has a capacity of handling at least 500 more calls. And depending on their location and distance, I still believe Indian Trails is going to be the lion's share of their call volume, keeping their response times within the 85% percentile. And until we start to see that there's a significant reduction in the response times from Station 23 to the future Palm Coast Park, we really don't feel that there needs to be a station in there at least 10 to 15 years. So looking at other DRIs, the Palm Coast Park DRI, they're asking for just under 5,000 dwellings. And if you do a conversion to figure out how much call volume that would generate. Palm Coast Park would be 2.3 people per residential unit. Somewhere in the range of about 12,000 people would be in that area. You times it times your 12%, so you're looking somewhere in the range of about 1,300 calls per year at build out many years from now. I'm convinced that we can still utilize Station 23 in that capacity until we've made that determination that the call volume is so great that it's drawing down the response time from that station well off into the future. Niyoga Lakes and Old Briggs Township has been on the books for a long time. We don't see any infrastructure going up, so we haven't calculated anything into that into the next 15 years, and we'll still continue to work with the planning department and find out when they want to start doing things, but that is not on our horizon in the near future. So getting into what the proposal is, to provide a basis for proposed impact fee for fire rescue, these fees would be used to pay for new development that results from increased demand, as I displayed. The fees are for pay for growth-related fire facilities equipment. It is not paid for personnel, and unfortunately, it's also not used to pay for replacement stations of already existing. The city's current charge of $223 per residential unit and 28 cents per non-residential square unit would increase to back to the normal rate of what it was in 2010, which was almost 52 cents a square foot. Residential calculation fees has been revised to be the $367 per year for an increase of $143. We identified the existing investment and future projects to serve in the growth of the future and determining the allocation of costs to be recovered from residential, non-residential class customers. We did have the opportunity to speak to the HBA, the Home Builders Association, and we got some information in from the apartment builders that I'm going to ask Mr. Thomas to speak about from Reftilis. They gave some compelling discussions as to what their concerns are, and I think he can address them. But one thing to keep in mind is the cost is the cost over the next 15 to 20 years for build out up until at least 2040. And how we get there is over a period of time. We're still going to have to expend the money. So whether we do it in partially more in commercial or partially more in residential, I believe Mr. Thomas would be able to shed some good light on what the the calculation is and methodology. So if we're looking at three additional stations, that would be the cost of about $14.9 million. That would take into account the Seminole Wood Station, which would be the priority. In 7 to 10 years would be Colbert Lane, in the Palm Coast West, which would be at least 12, 15 years out. Each would be equipped with a Class A pumper, brush truck, and utility truck purchased with the utilization of the fire impact fee. There'll be two mini stations that would be suggested. One would be required on Whiteview to handle the calls between station 21 and 25. The other station may not come to fruition if we can get citation built and with a response time would be picked up by Station 26 in the south end. A potential training facility off of the Palm Coast Park would be in the years 2030 to 2032 to account for our training that we, when we go to the training facility outside our area, we have to go to the other side of Pinnell. Station 24 usually takes a half an hour to drive from their station over to the other side of Pinnell. They're there for whatever the duration of the training is. They come back another half an hour, so just in travel, it's an hour's worth of drive out of the zone. By incorporating the training facility into Palm Coast Park Fire Station in 2030 or later, we're looking at bringing our training locally to the fire community inside the center of town instead of having to drive further away. Total future capital investments over the next 20 plus years would be $21.9 million. And we're asking to increase the residential fee per unit from $223 to $367, and actually to repost the non-residential from 28 cents back to 59 cents, which if we look back what our rate would be, we're still midway through other cities in the region for fire impact fee for the department. You can see that there's a lot of other places that have a much higher rate. We've done some research on St. John's, and they have a tiered system, which is kind of unusual out of what we would be looking for. But currently, right now, we are very low on the list, and by making this upgrade, both residentially and non-residential, would put us in a good place of comfort to afford what we need to pay for the next 20 years. One thing that it should be pointed out, back in 2010, when we did have our recession, we lowered the non-residential fee from the 52 cents down to 24 cents with the expectation it would spark building for non-residential. We didn't take the same approach with residential, although we could have, but we knew that the buildings would still be coming, and what we're asking to do is return the non-residential back to where we were 10 years ago, and to upgrade the residential to $143 to the $367. What our future plans are, in July, we'll be presenting the station staffing analysis report to Mr. Morton. It's in draft form right now. This is Initiative 1C and a 10-year plan. After his comments and recommendations, we would like to present to council for further review. This will help kind of bring all things together from the 10-year plan, the station location study, the impact fee study, and the station staffing study on exactly where we are now, how we're operating, and how we're interworking with other agencies, and give you a plan of what we're going to be doing in the near future. Right now, we can probably include Mr. DiLorenzo, who was helpful in the Home Builders Association meeting. He could probably shed some light on some of the concerns about what they had regarding the tiered system that they were looking at. And Mr. Thomas from Reptilis, he can also provide an additional explanation about how we came up with the two approach of non-residential and residential. And that concludes my presentation, Mayor. If you have any questions, or if any of the council members do, I'll be happy to try to answer.
Council members, let's start with just the questions for Chief Forte, and then we will ask Mr. DiLorenzo to provide any comments in regards to his meeting with the home builders, and then finally we'll go to our consultant for any additional questions or comments. So any questions for Chief Forte at this time? Did you want to start first or no? Vice Mayor Clufus?
Hey, thank you. Chief Forte, thank you very much for the presentation. My question, which I didn't ask during our meeting about the report, was is there a consistent CPI increase that is accounted for in this formula? I hadn't posed that question prior, and it may be a question for the consultant, but I saw that the CPI did fluctuate, especially back in the economic recession, but just to make sure, that probably includes a consistent buildup of our CPI, probably like 2.5%, 2% per year. If you could just confirm that, I'm just curious. Thank you.
I'd probably defer that to Helena, and I want to say it was around a 2.25 CPI over the lifetime, but she would probably have better numbers on that.
Yes, good morning. The study does include the CPI increase, and that's going to depend on what it comes in every year.
Understood.
Any additional questions, Council Member or Vice Mayor Clufus, or does that conclude for right now?
I can put my questions. Thank you.
Okay. Council Member Cuff.
Yes, Madam Mayor. This may be a joint question for Chief Forte and Mr. DiLorenzo. I know the chart that the Chief put up for us about different future projects needing service or possible service needs showed the State Road 100 DRI. I've heard nothing about that other than seeing a couple of hand-painted for sale signs going up and down on that property for several years. And I guess my question is, that wasn't taken into consideration as part of this proposal, Chief. And does our planning department have any, updated status on where that stands?
So I'll speak first on the fire component. We included this because it's still prevalent and it's a possibility, but we didn't include it in our calculations because if you look at the town center DRI of 250 homes times 2.3 people per home puts that in the range of about 7,000 people times 12%. You're still looking at a capacity at a Station 26 that could handle that call. And we're also considering that Station 92 will remain in that location and still be able to fill some of that capacity as well. This recommendation certainly is not asking the county to take hat in hand and leave their location, but we're going to also utilize our south end of Seminole Woods to increase response to those residents. But I think Jason can actually discuss how they're doing as far as planning.
Morning again, Mayor, City Council. There are several projects along State Road 100 that are moving forward, but the State Road 100 DRI property is not one of them. There hasn't been any movement on that in several years.
Okay.
That
answers my question, Mayor. Thank you.
Council Member Brinquino.
I basically don't have any questions, but I have a comment. And this is the third time I hear this presentation. And the more I hear it, the more I believe in it, the more I think it's accurate. This is a matter of safety. I ran on safety. This is a matter of safety versus cost. At the workshop, I mentioned it to people. Sometimes we are penny-wise and dollar-foolish. By adding this equipment and stations that are insurance companies that will bring their prices down if we bring mainly our response time down. And sure heck, if I need those firemen, if I need first responders, I want them there ASAP. If $143 more in a in impact fees, which comes to usually Home Builders Association, the builders will pass it on to the buyer. $143 in a 30-year mortgage will come to cents a month, cents, when you could save dollars if in insurance. Basically, I didn't hear yet the rest of the presentation, but remember one thing. Firemen wear badges. Firemen out there, if you're listening to me and every first responders, let your badge be my shield. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Aquino. I have a question on a couple of the items. I know, Chief, when we met and you went over this very comprehensive planned approach for the future, you mentioned sort of the design of the future facilities would be handled or managed, I believe, under Carl's team, which would sort of have a unified design. In your plan and discussions, has there been any thought around having efficient standards and buildings to reduce the operational costs long-term over electric capacity, those sorts of things that, you know, will add to additional cost over time? I know we talked about staffing, and I know we have some older fire stations in our city. I'm not sure if they've ever been examined for an efficiency study, and that might be somewhere where we can save some additional dollars here and there. But I'm talking about future facilities. I'd like to make sure when we're planning these future facilities that we are looking towards applications that could reduce the ongoing costs, not just with staffing, but operationally.
That's a great question, and yes, we're looking at that. Our initiative 1B deals with establishing a fire station's standardization that, like we did in 08 when we built stations 21 and 24 and 25, that was built by design that they had a lot of similarities. Well, in that time, last 12 years that we've been living in them, we found some things that we'd like to tweak or change or modify a little bit. And we're going to establish a team that will look at how we operate today and how we can incorporate not only just the LEED certifications and making it greener, but technology has come a long way since we built those stations. And now we've got, we call them shot clocks on the side of our stations, that when we get a call, it's going to show the employees exactly how much time it's taking them to get from where they are to into the truck. We'll establish a team and create a small report working with Carl and his team to find out what's worked and what hasn't worked, and then move on from there. But to just address the older station in the city is Station 22, and as much as that station does need to be replaced at some point, that can't be through fire impact fee. That's going to come out of ad valorem tax, and there's a few thoughts I'd like to share with that. First, the station's already established. It's already in place. They're running somewhere in the range of about 2,100 calls a year, maybe 2,000 calls a year. And if we spend $4 million to build a fire station, it's not going to change the response time of what we're doing for that 2,000 calls per year or that population. Yes, it does need to be updated. It needs to be maintained, but the $4 million cost would not come from impact fees, which is a little disconcerting when you're trying to watch where you're growing and how you're keeping up with the cost of the building. The fire impact fee program is a great way of at least maintaining the growth of where you're going in the next 5 to 10 years. But we really need to look at opportunities that are out there about building a new fire station for the older ones while they're still doing a good job of representing the county, the city's response.
Yeah, I would just, I know the school district just underwent a whole retrofit of their lights and did a new, like, LED program where they went into the schools, and they did see an overall initial savings per school. So I was talking to the electricians that work in-house at the school district, and they did it over COVID because everything was closed down, but I thought that was an interesting approach of at least trying to reduce the cost where we can, where we have control over today. I know this is not necessarily part of the impact fee study, but since we are forward-thinking, I want to make sure that we're taking those conversations into account today as we're going through this strategy. And as we as a council adopt this 10-year plan, that would be included as part of the approach, where I think that would make a lot of practical sense from the ongoing cost perspective. As you know, I continue to not only champion to invest in a well-planned departments within our city. Certainly our fire department is first and foremost a priority, as Councilmember Branquino stated, as a safety measure, which is essential for our residents. However, the ongoing cost is what we also need to plan for. And so staffing is one thing. We want to make sure that we have training as another aspect of that, right, to get well-trained, qualified individuals for you to staff within your department. But really the ongoing cost, and you don't think about it, but I know when I first became a county commissioner, I remember going from the old courthouse to the brand new government services building on State Road 100, and I was going through one night all the bill runs from FP&L. And the increase alone of the electricity costs from an old courthouse, which was obviously much smaller in scale, to what is there today was extraordinary. And you want to talk about savings, you could have staffed additional people, you could have done different projects with those dollars. So I just want to make sure we're being smart about all of this.
I'd ask Carl to chime in, because I know we did some minor renovations to Station 22 about 3-4 years ago, and I know we did some upgrades. I'm not sure exactly if he can chime in on exactly what we did.
I can jump in here. The fire stations were included as part of our citywide energy audit that was completed, and they did look at our stations. We did, even our stations that were built, the more recent ones, we did go back in and do some lighting retrofits to LED, because back when they were built, LED was kind of newer technology, very expensive. So we did go back and do some retrofits in terms of operational too, the way the lights in the bay were controlled, you know, because when they jump in the trucks and take off, no one's going to be hitting the light switch on the way out and those sorts of things. So we did do some modifications to the operational of the lighting in those facilities. So we did go back and do some. We really hit the target 5 to 10 year or less payback items. I think there are still some additional items, you know, in terms of longer term payback that could be done in some of those facilities. So we've hit some of them. There's still some more that we can go after, and we definitely will be looking at those sorts of things and anything new that we build, because you're right, that long-term ongoing, you know, cost is something that really needs to be looked at during that design phase up front.
Thank you. Mr. Roy.
Yeah, so to your point, Mayor, as we've evaluated and we continue to evaluate the council priorities, and I don't know if this has made it onto a slide, but I've been working with Carl, I've been working exclusively a lot with Matt Mansell, and you know, there's sometimes some great examples out in the world, and we have come across the Strategic Energy Action Plan that has been implemented by the town of Cary, North Carolina. They have some phenomenal strategies at reducing overall power consumption. In fact, their target was 13% citywide, and they actually calculated out, to your point, those percentages of how much that saves, what that saves the community in terms of dollars, in terms of manpower, what it saves in terms of environmental costs. And so what we're wanting to do is run our strategic plans, our fleet management update, our buildings that we keep talking about, our energy ROIs we keep talking about, but we'd like to do it comprehensively through a strategy that's going to affect the whole city, and bring back that action to council and say, this is a strategic approach to energy, to modernization, to retrofits, to fleet management and analysis, to how we want to achieve and identify council's goals for energy reduction and savings, and then how we prioritize and start working towards those. So excellent conversation, and we do look forward to bringing those ideas back this fiscal year and in developing a more complete approach to how we do this.
Well, I like the fact of, again, having a measurement where staff is now directed you know, by a council priority and strategy to minimize the impacts overall. So I appreciate that very much, and I like that it's not done in a silo, however, blanketing all of the different aspects.
Everything,
of
all of fleet, miles per gallon reductions to, you know, vehicle efficiencies and oil change use. It was an excellent template, an excellent example, and we're going to be working through it as a staff team. So thank you, Mayor.
And just to add, and then we'll have Jason comment on his meeting and discussions with the HBA. You know, Chief, I just really want to, again, applaud you. I know your team, if you want to talk about who on your team was part of this, I know many people were, but really the core group of developing this 10-year plan, I think that would be really great to note to the public.
Well, there's an old saying, if you want to look good, surround yourself with brilliant people, and that's exactly what we've done. Starting from the top with Brad Clark, who is the deputy chief, he comes to us with 35 years of experience, and 25 of those years is in the field of creating reports, studies, and the education level has been phenomenal. The command staff has had a lot of parts in putting the plan together. But we've got Kyle Berryhill, who is one of our battalion chiefs, who is both a proofreader and an author of the 10-year plan and the station location study, and working closely with Brad Clark. But as you go down the list of people that are doing things, we've had driver engineers who have a background in English studies that were proofreading the documents. We've had firefighters that have had a long history of writing reports, taking an active role into writing the reports. Every segment of the 10-year plan, where it talks about which teams were doing what, wrote a synopsis on what it is that they do. So if we talk about the home safety inspections, or we talk about our CPR program, everybody who is represented by a team, they all have the names, and each one of them wrote a summary up of what it is that they're responsible for and what their goals are. Just bringing these folks together in a semblance of what it is that they do and understanding the grand scope of all the things that we encapsulate. It was both, you know, exciting and scary that we've got so many of these balls juggling up in the air, and we've got so many quality people that are keeping them running. It's just a testament to the teamwork that we do from the bottom-up approach. As I tell everybody, I don't make a single rule and I don't write a policy. I just pay the bills, and we let these people do what they need to do to run the organization. It's been an exciting 2 years, and we're looking forward to the next many, watching these folks grow into a further capacity.
Yeah, and thank you for that, because again, I mean, you know, when I first sat down, just even having the approach of really looking at this comprehensively and not just building a station to build a station, but rather build the station for the exact needs depending on the growth, exactly, was important to hear.
Important.
That you were able to pivot in a way to say it doesn't make sense over in that part of our city. You know, however, this is where we're going to maximize those response time opportunities based on the data that we have coming in today and knowing the projections of what's forecasted tomorrow is just so important. It's important for the safety of our residents. It's important for future residents, but it's important for the overall health of our community, in particular, our business community. You mentioned, Councilmember Branquino, the ISO rating plays a particularly important part when we go through a planning exercise, and those response times do really matter, not with just people's lives, but when you're talking about the economic impact of the overall contribution it offers to our community, residential, and then overall commercial. Commercial sees a cost savings with the insurance aspect with a high ISO rating. So I think taking all that into account having that input is really important throughout this process. This is a long process. It's one we're going to hear, from different stakeholders in the community. And I just want to add one last thing. You're absolutely correct about time frame wise. And I want to share a quick story because I've never had to call 911 until my daughter had a seizure, and she was, laying on the side of a sidewalk, and it was traumatic to watch. And those minutes stop and seem like they're in slow motion as every second ticks away, waiting for your loved one to have the first responder show up. It was a lot sooner than what in my mind played, however, but it truly did save her life, and there's no doubt about that. It was a very serious issue and an incident that I'm forever grateful for, but it did really bring to light the importance of that moment that you may not always need it, but when you do need it, it is truly life and death. And so we cannot thank our first responders enough. There will never be enough thanks, but you truly are special people. So thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. And I would be remiss if I don't mention our extended family, to include Helena in finance, that has gotten us a lot of material information on where we were so we can figure out where we're going. JC DiLorenzo and his staff, Jose Papa, Ray Tyner, and their staff on exactly where we're growing into and timelines. They were integral in getting us the information. Also, Ray, Carl Cody and some of his staff about what is our expectations from engineering standpoint. Laura Castellanova on the GIS modeling, because everything that you saw with the dot, she was working with our computer gurus, Leo Chumacero and Julie Rivera, on how to create all these things. And there's a lot of people in the cities that really, when you ask them, I have a question about something, they really have an interest in helping you make yourself a success and making you better. And I felt very warmed and welcomed by everybody in the city that has been a big part of our creation of these documents. I know we're going to use them in the future, and it's been such a great experience.
Thank you. Jason DiLorenzo, can you please present or discuss the discussions with the Home Builder Association? Again, that's that advocacy arm of several individuals and stakeholders in this community, which, certainly this impacts.
Madam Mayor, yes, on June 10th, Chief Forte and myself and several of his team met with the Fogler Home Builders Association Government Affairs Committee. And we went through the presentation so they could get a feel for the 10-year plan and the financial needs of the fire department. they had two main questions that we discussed a little bit. And one was on the residential side, and they asked about if there should be excluding or a reduction of fees in areas that are nearby built out or essentially impact fee districts. My experience with impact fee districts is that they can cause dollars to be stuck in those districts because they can't be used citywide when the need arises, and specifically like you saw in this plan that it's a fluctuating plan. It's going to depend on where the development grows as where Chief is going to locate those stations to serve those new residents. So, and I'm sure Henry can touch on that a little bit as well. And as you know, fire services, they cross artificial boundaries all the time. If one group is in service somewhere, then another group comes to help, regardless if that is just right down the street. So setting up an artificial district to recover those dollars and maybe get them stuck there, I would not suggest. They also had a conversation about on the commercial side, if there should be a differential between commercial uses, maybe industrial warehouse or manufacturing or large-scale commercial should have a different fee for a different use. And we had a conversation with Mr. Thomas about that yesterday. I think he can expand on it. He has the expertise on this.
So Jason, before he does that, what was their thought process around that particular?
That the different uses should have a different fee. So maybe a manufacturing use that has more risk compared to a warehouse use that might have less risk, and or a commercial, a regular commercial building, a restaurant or store, that you would have a list of uses similar to a transportation impact fee schedule, where the uses are based on trips. And each of those uses, causes a specific number of trips.
So did they have data that demonstrated their reasoning behind that?
No, it was more of a discussion.
Okay.
So basically, they didn't challenge the $143 that we kind of raising it. It's just the way we do it, I gather, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Yes, sir. I think that's a good way to put it.
Okay, so we will now have our consultant, Mr. Thomas, sort of expand upon Jason's input in regards to the meeting with the Home Builders Association. And then, Council, if we have any particular questions for our consultant, I would open up after he answers these first two.
Good morning, Mayor and members of the City Council. Henry Thomas, a vice president with Reftalis, and we've been your rate and impact fee consultant for the city for a number of years now. I'm going to take the impact fee zone question first. I think Jason's correct in that these are not normally applied within municipalities. They're sometimes used in large counties. Because there's a significant difference in resources required to provide levels of service. But keep in mind that this fee is based upon assets, including existing assets, which we know have capacity to serve new growth that has not occurred yet, as well as new assets aimed at various areas within the city that are growing. So the blending of the fee is such that, again, you have infill in certain areas, even though they may be close to built out, they're in most of the areas of the city, there's still infill occurring. And again, we're asking everyone to pay that citywide fee, if you will. It would be very difficult to administer. And I think, keep in mind that the statute requires and the case law requires a reasonable nexus. There's no way to establish a perfect nexus in this kind of fee setting. So again, you will not see zones used very often, particularly as it relates to fire services. The second question they raise as regards to the differentiation of property types for the commercial, I want to point out that the allocation process is two steps. First, we use call data to allocate between residential and commercial. When you look at commercial classes, and if you rely on call data to take a step further on commercial by specific land uses, that can really be misleading because certain kinds of property in recent past may not have had a fire call. The methodology that's used to come up with these differentiations in fees for certain types of impacts due to growth, as Jason mentioned, the transportation is one where different property classifications have different charges. The methodology that's used to achieve those differences is called functional population, and it is based upon national data regarding trip generation that's published data. And what it's attempting to do is see where the population is at any given point in time. For example, a convenience store would have a higher population per square foot, functional population per square foot than a warehouse. And that's a given. However, that fits a lot better in my mind in the model where we might be talking about police impact fees or roadway impact fees. This is fire services, and EMS is another one where that functional population makes more sense. Fire services, I mean, I don't think you can question the link between square footage and the demand potentially for firefighting services. A larger building could well produce a higher demand for fighting that fire on that site. So again, with respect to the fact that it's fire services only, also the apportionment methodology that we've maintained in this study has been in place in the city for many years. We did not see an overwhelming or compelling reason to change that apportionment. And like I said, I think the square foot nexus for fire services is a very reasonable nexus. Again, if we were talking about roadways or our police or EMS, the functional population approach makes more sense. So you do see communities where the fire fees are differentiated by property type, but typically those communities, it's a combination of fire and EMS. So that's, again, my response to those questions.
Oh, let me ask a couple of questions. Have you ever seen, and maybe it's to Jason or someone else within our department, where a large DRI goes through an approval process, and part of that process includes the donation of a fire truck, donation of fire apparatus based on the scale of the proposed development. Have we ever looked at that? Has that ever been part of any conversation within the city of Palm Coast?
I can chime in about the donation of a fire truck. When the town center DRI was being considered, they actually came to Chief Beadle at the time and asked them, what did we need? And knowing the facility and what was expected, we asked them for the purchase of a fire truck, and they basically stroked a check the next day for the purchase of the ladder truck, which is going on 15 years old now. So it's quite conceivable that the developer and the builders already know that there's going to be an impact, but I would rather defer to Jason as to what is standardized as opposed to what happened 15 plus years ago. There's a methodology that I'm sure has to be put into place now as to what constitutes an acceptable DRI improvement.
Yes, Mayor, it's not uncommon for a development, large-scale development, to have a contribution in some way to the public use. Often that will be an offset to the impact fee that it's related to.
Have you ever heard of that, Matt?
So, you know, I have, and this might be a question for Bill. So in my experience, for my entire career, we've allowed that or done that through concomitant agreement. What becomes tricky is, I think Bill will comment, it has to be voluntary, especially when you have an impact fee already covering that cost center. It has to be a voluntary, you know, we can't require that as part of a development. We have seen and negotiated with developers for level of service, for desirability of developments to do those kinds of things. But I think at the end of the day, if this is more than a pragmatic approach, it starts with a legal basis and having those negotiations outside of impact fee collection.
Right, and in this particular case, this situation, the question has been about fire, and we're going to talk about parks in a second. But a lot of times, you'll and we've had this come up many times, where you'll see as part of a development for traffic impact fees, for traffic impact, you'll see a developer as part of their construction project put in an extra lane or they'll widen a road. And that's kind of the same thing from a traffic standpoint as what we're talking about today. It's a cost that the developer is paying out of their own pocket, and it's associated with the impacts on the level of service that that development is causing on level of service, growth impacting level of service. That's the legal basis for why local governments can charge these impact fees as opposed to taxes. So we have to, and the tricky part is, as Matt said, the tricky part is you've got to account for the relationship and the quantity of the impacts to the amount of money that these developers are contributing or paying as fees. And then that amount will be a credit, as Mr. DiLorenzo said, against the ultimate impact fee that these developments will have to pay at the time that they become due. And
the point of the question, I'm sorry to interrupt, was in what circumstances, or is it part of our process that we ask for those, not in lieu of, but in addition to, and again, that goes back to that, we can certainly ask, but that nexus of, hey, you have an impact.
It's just an option. It's certainly an option that a developer could choose, but at the end of the day, they're going to demand that they receive some sort of credit towards their ultimate responsibility and obligation for impact fees.
Sometimes. More often than
that. I've seen it done throughout parts of the state where even the developer has offered to build the fire station, a very large-scale development, because they could do it less expensive, you know, even for the standards. It was north of us that happened. So I just want to make sure, you know, when we're looking long term, especially with the new development, I mean, we have existing centers that the chief referred to in his plan, existing neighborhoods that will see future growth pockets that will demand additional levels of service. But when we're looking in particular, you know, west of US 1, we've got large tracts of land. Whenever Neoga Lakes ever comes back, if it does in its format, and Old Brick Township, I mean, those are two projects that I know on a large scale we're really going to have to sit down and think through, frankly, on those, you know, how we serve that community in the best way possible, not to overtax or overburden our current residents. And that's always been the point of impact fees. It's that one-time contribution of the impact of the growth that development is creating, or that additional calls for service, not the ongoing costs. But we do have, I've looked at projections the other day, I mean, built out, the city of Palm Coast is projected to be around 100. If built out as designed today, with the available land, it's somewhere in the range of 198,000 residents. I mean, that's double of what we're talking about today, and that means a conversation that councils today should be putting in place. This is why we're having this conversation, to help have a source of funding to be able to keep up with, not growth does not pay for itself, although people say that it just doesn't. The ongoing costs of services are very expensive, but in particular fire services are. I just want to make sure we're looking at this, again, those pockets, and if there's any other ways, we can always say, let's bring the three DRIs together and have those conversations when they're coming forward. Let's try to look at this and scale it and scope it the best we can.
Just to dovetail off of that, there's a certain amount of opportunity that presents itself when you've got this much growth going on. And it's possibly that, you know, a lot of it is the greatest location for actual dirt. If we could find a place to put the right station at the right location, would be very helpful. You know, one of the things about Station 22, the oldest station, is it is in an uncomfortable area that it's limited, it's landlocked, the size of it is small. But we've got limited choices, and if a builder would like to discuss things like we've done with Kohl's, Station 21 was right across from Albertson, which was then, it's now Publix, and Kohl's wanted that location to put their building, and we were in the way. And what they did was, it wasn't so much of a DRI request, but it was they were willing to not only put us on a different piece of land, which was in a good location, but they built the building for what would be, I think, $2.9 million. That was a public partnership with the community that we relocated. We brought in a box store, and it served its purposes. But you know, we I'm sure if Jason or Carl would like to discuss anything at a different time or another point in the discussion about moving properties around and making that discussion.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. I know this is a little bit off course, but I just want to make sure, again, since we're talking about the future 10-year plan of our fire department, that we're considering all aspects of relationships with the those that are, you know, going to be impacting that growth. So I appreciate the response and the answer. And to the consultant, I know I asked last night of Matt and Jason and Chief Forte as well had responded about, you know, that comparison to St. John's County and how they have a different calculation. And I appreciated both Jason's and the Chief's response in regards to the state does not have a unified calculation requirement. So the consultant is, you know, how, you know, why we retain them in order to best adhere to what our priorities and goals are. And so to the consultant, can you just speak to that? I'm not sure if you were the who was the one that approached the St. John's County impact fee formula, but I'm just curious to hear a little bit more about the tiered approach and what you see around the state and what other municipalities are doing and why.
Okay. Well, one, I did not gather that information. Staff did. So if you'll, with my apologies, the tiering that went into that fee, gentlemen, is that on the commercial side and or both commercial and residential?
It appears to be both commercial and residential, and just looking at it today, had an opportunity to run some numbers, but for a tiered approach to permit fee impact, you've got a home that's going to be built between 1,200 and 1,800 square feet. Their impact fee is $492, but when you start getting into what's more customary in Palm Coast, the impact fee for an 1,800 to 2,500 square foot residence is $609. It's considerably higher, and that's asking the residents to absorb that amount of the cost. But then you go down to what would be considered a commercial structure under 100,000 square feet. They're looking for $115 per 1,000 feet. So you look at that same rate is a $1,700 impact fee for something that would be in the range of about 15,000 square feet. So that same 15,000 square foot structure for, or that relation, it goes up incrementally, and the higher in square footage you go, the price gets smaller, but you're still paying a very large price. I think Jason said it best yesterday in our meeting. The amount of cost outlay to build the structures over the build out of the city is the number, and it's how we assess the people that are going to be impacting the community. He gave the analogy of squeezing the balloon on one end, it's going to inflate in the other. So if we don't price it out correctly and according to the same formula that we're using for non-residential and residential, there's always going to be some group that's going to feel that they're paying more than they ought to. At the end of the day, when we impose the fee, the fee is a one-time charge to the builder, whether it's residential or non-residential. The fee is processed, but when the building's done and the builder is completed with the project, Fire Services is going to have to service that building indefinitely for the rest of our lives. So, you know, it might be an incremental cost increase today, but we're still looking at an impact to the community. And I think what Mr. Thomas has demonstrated is it's as fair as it could possibly get without getting into the micro minutia of getting into the detail that really doesn't warrant.
So if I could address the residential feature of having it be applied by the size of the home. First of all, that would not be a typical approach. I can assure you that most communities that charge fire impact fees, they don't tier it by size of the home. Secondly, while as I indicated, we do two allocations. One is based on overall call data between residential and commercial. And then within commercial, we do have a per square foot factor built in. But if you think about the capacity to fight fires on the residential side of the equation, does it really create a huge difference in cost of assets required, meaning fire stations and fire trucks and such, because a home is 1,800 square foot versus 2,200 square foot. And the other thing I'll tell you is, you know, we see some communities that do a tiered approaches to things like stormwater. And what happens once you tier it, then people are concerned about either side of that tier. If I fall in the smaller one or I'm just over the threshold, how is that fair? And so there's, again, a lot of factors that you could take into account to try to make the fees less for smaller homes. In my view, most of those are probably political considerations, to be honest with you, as opposed to the true cost. And like I said, I think the cost per dwelling unit is certainly a reasonable allocation. And I think would be hard to make the case that we can somehow link a higher or lower cost depending on the size of the dwelling unit.
That is a very fair response. I just wanted and needed you to defend it and your approach, because I've just been doing a lot of research on just really the overall calculation and again how it came to be, and to the Chief and Jason's point. I mean, the budget is the budget. You know, it's a well thought out budget. It isn't something where we just threw a number on the wall and wanted it to stick. So a lot of time went into this preparation. I know many hours. So I just am trying to get a thorough understanding of the approach, so I can understand in all fairness how the calculation came to be.
Sure. And again, I would just reiterate that the approach used by St. John's County is more the exception than the rule. When we look across Florida communities and how they apply impact fees for fire services.
Okay. Okay, Council, any other questions or comments at this time for anybody on our entire staff? We'll now open it up to the public. This is for anyone to comment on agenda item number H4. If you wish to do so, please call in at 386-223-1600. Yes. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, hi, my name is Mark Langello, and I was at the HBA meeting. I'm on the board for the HBA. At first, I'd like to thank the chief and Jason DiLorenzo for the, and I think there was another staff member there for coming, or virtually coming to the meeting and giving us the information. We were basically very pleased with the approach that the city had come up with to do the substation and to be to come up with that approach rather than just building a full station, to have a more reasonable approach on the cost of building that substation and how to service those calls, and I guess it was the Red Mill area. I was the one raising the question about the commercial. My experience is I'm a commercial developer and a commercial builder. And I do know that there's a lot of different types of commercial, and there's different probably risks involved with each one, both on the fire and on the emergency calls. I was asking to find out what the process was to analyze that, because it was just sort of a blanket approach. And we didn't really have that information available to us. I can also tell you that our meeting went long and we had to cut it off. I did hear, I guess, Chief Forte talk a little bit about some more statistics. My thought was not necessarily about having it related to square footage, more to the use, because the use may dictate how much, how much demand that a type of business had. And Jason touched upon it earlier. If you have a warehouse building and you may have, a few people in a large space, versus if you have an activity building that has an awful lot of activity, and it could be a manufacturing, it could be a restaurant, you're going to have a lot more both fire and medical service type of calls. And then when you multiply the square foot number times the size, that it seems that it may not be equitable to some types of users versus others. And the unintended consequence would be is that some, by sort of penalizing or overcharging some people, that development may not happen as much in the city. It's a hard thing to quantify. I can tell you on my side as a developer, I definitely hear it. I'm doing a 15,000 square foot warehouse building that we're in the planning process in the city right now, and our impact fees are high, many, 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 many thousands of dollars. That's the whole range of them. And it does affect the buyers. They look at this and they shake their head and they go, wow, I mean, this is costing a lot of money. And it factors into
a few more seconds.
Obviously, we'd want to be able to,
I'm sorry. Your 3 minutes are up, Mark. I appreciate your comments. We'll take those into consideration. Thank you.
Hi, Anna Maria Abad, Executive Officer of the Flagler HBA. Again, to echo what Mark was saying, thank you, Jason and Chief Forte and another staff member. I'm sorry we didn't catch your name, for coming to our Government Affairs Committee virtually. We were super impressed with the presentation. We take no issue with the residential side. Like you said, Honorable Mary Holland, if I need emergency services, I want them there fast. I do ask that we take some time to further evaluate the commercial side of things, and if there's any possibility of looking at what Mark was saying. I do think it makes sense to a degree, and I just want to explore it. And while it may not be the typical thing that's done, I don't think that's stopped Palm Coast before. We're forward thinking, we're forward moving, and it may make sense especially when we do struggle to bring in commercial business, and we do see a lot of commercial business come in, start the permitting, and we say, nope, sorry, this is not good. Like, I can do this somewhere else, easier, cheaper, whatever. So I'm interested in bringing more business to the area, more fruitful business to employ our residents. I would like to ask that that's further investigated and explored. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker. To the two commenters, I will ask if any staff members would like to comment on their comments. I am certainly thinking them through and have some thoughts. And then we'll open it up to any additional questions by our council before moving forward. Jason or Chief or Matt, did you want to add anything to both the commenters? Again, particularly honing in on the commercial and our consultant, if he has any thoughts, since that's what we've contracted him to do as well.
I just got a quick comment, and I want to thank Mark for his rendition of Stump the Professor the other day, because the two-tiered approach was something that I just haven't considered, because this is our first real go-around. But in speaking with Mr. Thomas about it's not so much that the square footage of a residence is going to be different in doing that, but we ran into that 77 Hargrove experience a very bad fire due to arson. And not only did it overwhelm our services for that day, but we were occupied physically on that property for weeks during the investigation and suppression efforts. It's an understanding that commercial plays a vital role in bringing people to the community. But at some point, we also have to find out what is the best way that we can both provide the impact to the community for the residents and the commercial. I appreciate their comments, and Mr. Thomas wants to chime in. And
can you speak about the ISO rating for commercial? I know when you were presenting, I had asked the question about the insurance and the ISO rating. It was either Brad or Kyle or you, maybe it was Brad, that pointed out that the commercial sees a greater savings with a higher ISO rating than residential normally would.
It's something that we've reviewed. That's a hidden secret that you really can't get much out of the insurance company, except for the fact that when your insurance rating, your ISO rating changes, there'll be an increment, and we don't know what that formula is outright because it's proprietary. But we do know that we're an ISO rating of 2, and by increasing our response capabilities and reducing our response times, one of the things that we're looking at is expanding out is the ladder truck to improve our ISO rating. And not that we want to throw a lot of money at trying to be a better number, but the more you work on the training and the water supply and the dispatching and the department operation as an entity, the better the rating. We are posed to get a rating of 1 in the next 2 to 4 years. And without having to throw a tremendous amount of money at fire stations, we can possibly get there sooner. The rates that a commercial industry will save on their insurance is much more affordable than if we stay at a 2 by going to a 1. And it's, you'll see it better on a commercial property than you would actually a residential property. And that's about it.
So, Chief, if I could add again a comment regarding the allocation of the costs. Again, keep in mind that when the reference is made to risk, we really don't have a reliable source of data which speaks to the risk of a fire occurring at different kinds of properties. If you look at the use of the risk in that regard. So the methods that are used to create these differentials in commercial rates for various impact fees are based upon trip data that says how many people are going to a convenience store versus a restaurant versus a retail per square foot. So it's kind of trips per square foot. And as I indicated earlier, I think it makes a lot of sense when you're talking about certain kinds of impact fees to have that differential. But with respect to fire services exclusively, the larger warehouses can entail a major fire risk, if you will, or firefighting needs relative to their size. regardless of the amount of trips that occur. So again, it's not, both these methods in this case of differentiating by property type are in use, but many communities on the fire side are also recouping EMS services, which in my mind makes the use of the trip data a little more relevant because of the need to provide capacity for EMS. So again, I think it is a fair a square foot based upon the cost of firefighting capacity is reasonable. Could we look at it differently? Yes, but I think this is a reasonable nexus. And again, one that other communities use and that the city has used for many years. So I just didn't see a compelling reason to go further with it than per square foot.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. One thing, Mayor, to point out is we've been 10 years now since we dropped the level from 52 cents to 24 cents a square foot. We've had a lot of growth in that 10-year period, and if we would have stayed on the path at 52 cents and going at the current rate of growth, by today we would have been clearly over 60 cents a square foot if we kept to the CPI. We're just looking to return the commercial rate to where it was 10 years ago, and had we left it where it was, it probably would have had an impact on commercial growth then. It's been 10 years. I think at this point, returning it to where it needs to be, or at least where it was 10 years ago, is a responsible starting point.
Thank you for your comments. Council, any questions or additional comments for anybody that's presented or spoken?
Not at this time.
You know, this is a first reading, so, you know, hopefully the dialogue will continue, certainly with the Home Builders Association before the next reading. Jason, Chief, I just encourage you to continue to please allow for input and any type of additional comments that would be helpful throughout this process. I do really appreciate their participation and their comments there today. They've listened to a lengthy dialogue and they've been really supportive of hearing the city's approach. And so I want to make sure we're continuing to have that conversation. Does
Thank
that
you,
work, Mayor. Matt?
Absolutely.
Okay. Council, do I have a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Roll call, please, Virginia.
Vice Mayor Clufus?
Aye.
Councilmember Branquino?
Yes.
Councilmember Cuff?
Yes.
Councilmember Howell?
Yes.
Mayor Holland?
Yes.
Mayor, this motion passes 5-0.
Thank you. We'll now move to agenda item number H5, which is an ordinance. Mr. Reichman?
Yes, Mayor. Council. The title of this ordinance is an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Palm Coast, Florida, amending Chapter 29, Impact Fees, Article 3, Park System Impact Fees, amending Sections 2974, Adoption of Impact Fee Formula, Amount of Park Impact Fee, and Section 2976, Use of Proceeds, Cost of Ordinances of the City of Palm Coast, Providing for Applicability Codification for Conflicts, and Providing for an Effective Date.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Mayor, City Council. Just as by way of reminder, the Parks and Recreation Impact Fee update was on a coherent track, again, prior to COVID-19, so it's coming back. This impact fee is driven specifically by level of service, and that level of service is of course, driven by community input as to what our community should be. But saying that, level of service impact, especially as it pertains to parks, needs to be reevaluated and adjusted to continue to plan for the dynamic nature of new growth patterns and new population growth. So that's why we're here today. The parks and amenities are what makes one of the many facets, but a big facet, what makes Palm Coast such an attractive place to live, and we hear that from our residents all the time. Today, what we've asked, again, since it did have a delay in the process because of the COVID-19, for Lauren Johnston to give us an update and a recap of where we're at and how we arrived today at this first read at the proposed parks impact fee. We also have Carl and Jason on standby, as well as the consultant to answer specific questions. So with that, Lauren, I'd ask you to present.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Lauren Johnson, Director of Parks and Recreation, here to present on the Park and Recreation Impact Fee update.
Good morning, or good morning. Afternoon.
Just a little bit of background. The impact fee provides a basis of proposed impact fee for parks and recreation services. Fees are typically paid by new residential development that results in an increase of demand. Fees are used to pay for growth-related parks and recreation facilities. The current recreation impact fee is $849.24 per residential dwelling unit, and that includes a $575.95 discount. The fee was last reviewed in fiscal year 2014. Where we have been in the past, January 14th, we did a council workshop impact fee study results, which included our consultant to present. On January 30th, we did a public outreach meeting at the community center. On February 18th, there was a Home Builders Association meeting. We brought this item to council for feedback on workshop on March 10th to discuss the public meeting feedback and determine a 90-day grace period. We're in a lag due to COVID-19, but we're here again to discuss at the business meeting today and July 7th to adopt an impact fee ordinance. The Parks Master Plan was completed and adopted by City Council in 2008. The vision statement consisted with the city's comprehensive plan. 12 projects have been completed since adoption to present, and there are 13 major projects currently identified as eligible for impact fee funding. The Recreation Impact Fee's current strategy is to focus on grant-funded and partnership projects. We have several of these projects listed, the Lehigh Trailhead at Belterre with FDOT, Waterfront Park Water Access with FIND grants. We're focusing on critical needs and satisfying obligation. We've expanded parking and fields at Indian Trails Sports Complex, and we're working through a plan for parking at the community center per council priority. And then capacity improvements such as add projects to coincide with development and available funding. In Carl's CIP presentation that he provided to council, he outlined additional impact fee per this rate study and the additional revenue that we would receive if the proposed impact fee is approved. And then today we're here to take council action, adopt the proposed park and rec impact fee of $1,549 that was identified in the rate study, and approve the ordinance today to include the use of impact fees for future updates, include the annual construction cost index, and review every 5 years or as major changes occur fees periodically, and establish a 90-day grace period from adoption. And that concludes the presentation. Mayor, Council, if there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Council, any questions and comments on this agenda item for Lauren at this time?
Not at this specific time.
I have a question about the park plan. So that was developed in 2008, and you had mentioned the projects that have been completed within that plan. Has there been any discussion around a brand new parks and recreation plan since then? I mean, that's 12 years old, and have what outstanding projects are listed in that plan that would be included in the projects moving forward that would have the impact fees fund some of those?
So Carl, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Parks and Recreation Master Plan is a 30 to 50 year long range document, and it includes that level of service for present funding and then future funding. So we're concurrent with the current master plan, and also the master plan was sent before council to be reviewed and updated not too long ago. Carl, can you correct me if I'm wrong there?
Yeah, I believe it's since 2008, the park master plan that really outlines the projects has gone back to council twice. I believe it was in 2012 and then maybe 2 years ago. And that's the time when there's a little more refinement, and if there's a change in strategy, whether projects get added or removed from that overall plan.
How many projects are still remaining? 13 are completed, correct?
I think there are 12 are completed, and there's 13 major projects identified still to be done. Some of those are neighborhood parks. Some of those are centers, which could be a senior center, a rec center, you know, okay. Community center. The plan doesn't get into that finite detail. That the actual program and use would be determined by council in terms of the needs at the time. You know, as you say, as time goes on, what the community needs can be adapted.
That makes sense then. So these are just either amenity-driven or facility-driven, correct? And different
correct.
Locations?
Okay. Yes.
That's helpful. And it takes into consideration future developments and growth?
Yes, all of them except for like the Niagara Lakes and Old Brick. Since those are so far out, those projects and dwelling units were left out of the study.
And within the projects, were there any properties identified that was donated for future recreational sites and amenities?
Yeah, in the overall rate analysis, no cost for land purchase was included. The goal was to use existing land, or when development occurred, that there would be a donation of land or an offset with some impact fees that the developer would pay. So we didn't include any cost for land purchase
okay.
in the plan.
Okay. Those are my questions for right now. Councilmember Howell?
Yes, ma'am. One thing that I just want us to think about, we've got the impact fee for the fire department, and we have the impact fee increase for our parks and recreation. Do you think, given the currency of the economic downfall that we've experienced and the projected long-term requirement for it to get back to being robust, that we can do both of these impact fees? I just want you all to think about that.
Okay. I have an additional question before we open up to the public. So this study that we just contracted to do, so that normally a review of impact fee studies is done normally every 10 years, 7 to 10 years?
I would have to ask Carl for the exact date. I am not sure of that answer.
The consultant recommends every 4 to 5 years, or if there's a major development change within the community that would trigger a need to do an update.
And one of the reasons that we do this, as I'm sure you're aware, Mayor, periodically, is that we have to legally support the amount of fees that we charge. We're going to have to establish in response to a challenge that the amount of the fees are have this reasonable relationship. So if you wait too long between the times you update them, it makes it harder to establish to a court in a challenge that there was this relationship between what our current needs are, what our growth is and has been and anticipated in the future. So you have that nexus. That's why you do the updates.
So for this particular item, again, if we adopt the ordinance as read with the recommendations, but historically, a reduction took place, I'm assuming by a council decision due to the economic climate. When does that take place? When did that recommendation take place? So the calculations were established. At some point, a former council proposed reducing the contribution, not the calculation, but the actual contribution for a period of time. Was that sunsetted, or was that just a period of time without a date attached? How
that,
was
the
that?
Latter. That is my understanding, the latter. There was a decision made that based upon economic considerations, it would be in the best interest of the public and the city not to try to discourage growth, discourage development by reducing, by decreasing, reducing the impact fees. And that was left for future councils to consider when to modify that decision, to leave it, to continue to leave it reduced, or to bring it back up to an amount that is supported by the study that you have before you today.
So what process is that? Is that just a council meeting, or is it a new ordinance on top of this, or is this a resolution? How is that codified?
Well, the prior decision would have been done by ordinance. They would have had to have amended the code of ordinances to reduce the impact fees, whatever impact fees were reduced. We're talking right now about park. But these are codified, so in order to take some action to bring your park impact fees up above what was previously done, you are going to have to pass an ordinance to amend your code of ordinances.
So that wasn't just, that was literally codified, that amount that...
the reduced amount. Warren? Absolutely.
Okay.
The reduced amount.
All right. I'm just trying
to... legislative action.
Just trying to state if there is a process, if this was adopted under first reading, there's still a second reading that's required.
Correct.
Today, if there could be a recommendation associated with it, again, not to take away from future councils, perhaps that want to make sure if there's projects that they want to make sure are funded, because of the growth that's occurring, you know, that they have the opportunity to do that, since we have contracted with a study with a professional consultant that makes these calculations based on the information and the factual information that's supported.
Correct.
For them to do so. So,
and as was said earlier, normally, you look at 4 to 5 to 6 years just because things in a normal world can change. Something can happen. We've seen that in the last 6 months, where there can be occurrences that you may need to look at that more frequently. But that's the time frame that your consultant indicated and staff has indicated. That's the general norm.
Okay. Councilmember Cuff.
Yes. It's been a while since we discussed this at workshop, and I just want to make sure I'm clear. I'm sure it's in the backup, but there's a lot of backup. The current fee that is paid is $849 and change. Is that correct?
Yes, Councilmember Cuff, that is correct.
Okay. And what would that fee be had the council not adopted the discount, or whatever we want to call it, back whenever they did that?
It would be the $849 and $575 added together. It would be the current fee.
So basically what we're proposing to do is take away the discount, I mean, in terms of dollars and cents.
Yes, sir.
That's helpful, Bob. Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I was clear on that, that the $849 wasn't the full fee that had been recommended, 10 years ago or whatever it was.
No, it would have been $1,425.19 was the recommended fee, but there was a $575.95 discount applied to that fee, giving the current unit at $849.24.
Okay. Mayor, I think it's important, just for the record and for the public, what we're doing today is not just reversing what was done historically. The action you're being asked to consider today is consistent with a study that was just completed to justify all the legal requirements to support a fee of the $849 plus the $575. I think it's important to make sure everyone understands. We're not just reversing what was done previously. What we're doing today is supported as legally required by a professional study.
That's helpful. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I was just saying, I like the consistency. I mean, we talked about that. The level of service the community has asked for and councils consistently have asked for is that $1,400 amount to fund appropriately the plan, and we're back to that same number. And I found that remarkable as we worked through this analysis. Yep.
Council Member Cuff?
Yes, I just wanted to, I appreciate the city attorney's comments and that I was just looking at dollars and cents because that was my understanding. I understand that the current proposed fee is based on the new study, not just adding back in what we haven't been charging for the last however many years to the old fee that would have had to have been based on its own study, I assume.
Well, thank you to the two attorneys debating this issue very clearly.
No debate.
I found both of your comments actually extraordinarily helpful. It's helped in my thought process, so thank you. Okay, we will now open it up to the public. Any member of the public wish to make public comment on 386-223-1690. Please state your name for the record.
There are two, Mayor. Just by way of reminder, if you could dial *9 to indicate you want to speak, that'd be helpful.
Hello again, Mark Langiello. I'm going to try to keep this into 3 minutes. It's very difficult. Unlike the last impact thing, which we did agree the level of service, and we agreed that the NHPA, that we agreed that the need was there, we're not necessarily agreeing that the plan developed 12 years ago is necessarily reflective of the needs for the city. We have a lot of different issues we brought up to staff. We never really got them all resolved. It's hard to go through it all at this point, but we do think that a more relevant analysis of what the city wants in this day is probably appropriate versus a very limited 2008. Also, the impact that this would have on current building. I know that Commissioner Howell just brought that up to a small degree, and we think that it does have an effect. It may have a twofold effect. You may see a flood of applications at one point and then a lull in them going forward. People trying to beat that increase. It is a big increase. We've also talked about if there was an increase, could it be stepped? There was a lot of different aspects to owning a park. It's not just the cost of building it, it's the cost of the legacy cost of owning it and the effect that they may have, and is the public and staff fully aware of these effects? Some of them is not just monetary, but could be crime. People, too many parks, especially underutilized, may cause drug sales and illegal activities, and people may get mugged and things that there aren't a lot of people at. There's a lot of different ramifications. So we thought it would be more prudent to wait on this, to table this item, and to have more robust conversation with not only the HBA, but the community as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker.
Hi, Anna Maria again. Promise it's my last time. First, thank you, Lauren and Parks and Rec. You've been incredible in managing all the facilities and communicating with the public. You guys did those awesome Facebook videos throughout the pandemic, and round of applause. So our parks are valuable for residents and visitors. I personally utilize multiple facilities as a five-year-old, so we like to get energy out. The issue is not with the legality of it. It's not with the rational nexus. We're not questioning, was the impact fee study done correctly? There's no doubt that it was done correctly. The issue is, the impact fee study was based on a master plan from 2008, and it has had very little public input since that time. The only public input it had was 38 residents and a few special interest groups. Many of you are on Facebook. You go on any of the groups and parents go back and forth of what we should have, what we shouldn't have. People want to be heard. Obviously, Facebook's not the way to be heard. So I recommend that a survey go out to reevaluate the needs and wants in a reasonable fashion to the community. That can be done via the Palm Coast Connect app. It can be done by emailing utility customers. That cannot be done in-house with the communications department. The coronavirus effects are lagging indicators. It's going to likely be a year before we see the true impact of costing of materials going up and things like that. We've seen interest rates on homes, you know, fluctuate throughout this time, and it's just a very uncertain time. With that, I understand that it's not viewed as an increase because it's kind of removing the discount. But in practice, and in the reality of things happening, it does double the fee. Okay, the dollars do double. There's no question about the value of our parks and facilities. The questions are, does the master plan truly reflect the needs of our citizens, or is it the wishes of a small group from over a decade ago? Why are the impact fees being reassessed right before any census comes out? They inherently won't be accurate. The level of service won't be accurate. This could be tabled and taken care of with getting public input via surveys, not just meetings. Not everyone can make it to those. And having accurate data from the census, we all know how important that data is. And this is being, everything was based on the estimated 2010 census. That was a decade ago, according to your master plan. So that is our suggestion to table it. If you choose not to table it, we respectfully ask that you step the increase. Maybe to that 50% right now, maybe take it to 75% for 6 months and then to the full amount that you needed to get to. But I think it's very important to hear from the citizens of Palm Coast. We have voices and they deserve to be heard. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next speaker.
Hi, Mayor Harlan and City Council. This is Scott Sowers, the president of the Home Builders Association. Wanted to thank you for taking my call, and I just wanted to kind of read into the record the email that I sent out to everyone last night, that the Flagler Home Builders Association was happy to be a part of the initial workshop with the city staff, and I believe that we did have a fruitful dialogue with thoughtful questions about the reasons why we needed to see the park fee increase. At this time, though, we feel that the answers that were given back to us regarding our questions at the workshop still needed further vetting to confirm that we are reacting based on facts and not wishes of a very small minority of citizens that were a part of the original master plan for parks in the city. And due to the inability to have face-to-face meetings and dialogue with city staff, the Flagler HPA respectfully requests that this item be tabled until face-to-face meetings are allowed and additional information regarding our original questions can be provided and discussed in more detail. But as always, we look forward to working with the city to make these changes fair to everyone involved. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I'll close public comment. I'll make a couple of comments, and I know, Matt, you want to make a couple of comments as well to the speakers. You know, the sheriff and I have conversations that are always ongoing about the investment the city makes in public safety. Public safety is not just investing in additional deputies that ensure calls are responded to with a variety of issues that are in need of a response from law enforcement. We do invest in quality of life, and our parks are a subset of that. You just heard earlier today the reopening of our sports complex and our different fields and the sports organizations, and the amount of children that have participated has grown tremendously over the years. And so those organizations are invaluable as a component to our public safety. It does provide a level of activity for our youth that keeps them safe and in a team-building exercise that families have come to enjoy and love. And so realistically, we know our community is growing. There's no doubt that the numbers are there. Jason DiLorenzo can speak to the continued uptick of permits that we're seeing. And so it's finding that balance, and it's ensuring that we're always looking 5, 10, 15, 20 years out of different areas of our community that do need the neighborhood parks, that do need a place for families to be outdoors and enjoy. We continue to build on our infrastructure with our trails and our trail network that continues to drive a level of health and wellness to all ages of our community. And I know we do a national survey every other year, and then we have also put out different questionnaires to our residents. Denise, I know you're here. Can you speak to some of the aspects of the questions around parks and recreation and quality of life and what our residents have provided us over the years as far as input on a scorecard on how we're doing?
Yes, thank you, Mayor. Denise Bevan, City Administration Coordinator. To your point, we do provide every other year the National Citizen Survey that does one of two things: provide us the input from our citizens through a scientific approach, and then also it benchmarks us against other communities. Quality of life, we've always scored very high, and within that element, there's a lot of attributes that go into what citizens may be thinking when they elect to score us high. One of those is our parks and our trails, which have also rated high along the trend of the numerous years we've been doing the survey.
That's helpful. Just again, because I want to make sure we're continuing to refine that, but offer that moment of reflection, because that does help us not only build our strategic action plan and goals and priorities for that singular year. However, it goes into how we fund projects 5 and 10 years out in our capital plan. In particular, how we balance our sales tax revenue and our strategies around maximizing those dollars to make them go as far as possible. And I say all this because, again, I do have great respect for our Home Builders Association and the input in which they have contributed to this process. And, you know, there is a lot of thought that goes into this. But I just wanted to make it clear, because I know the comment around crime, there's a lot of things that the city does invest in, again, not just specific to the law enforcement strategies, but really to provide a well-rounded community with different offerings. You saw our golf course reopen and how many rounds in 1 week. You saw our tennis facility open and that type of play again. Our pickleball is a growing entity that really offers those services, and our community center with a tremendous amount of programs. So we know that we are at capacity with our community center. We know that there will be a need to add an additional center that will allow our residents that offering on a continual basis. So, but I do know there has to be that balance, and we have to strike that balance, and we have to consider all aspects of these fees. And so some of the questions I will be asking are pertaining to sort of that time frame wise and what we're looking towards. Matt, did you want to add anything?
I was, but I would just be repeating what you said. So, thank you. Yes. Sorry.
No, sorry. I just, I think it's not, oftentimes residents don't see, law enforcement is one aspect of it, and first response and safety. But there's a whole other aspect that goes into an offering that a city invests in that allows for us to be a safe community, frankly. There's a reason that our crime statistics are extraordinarily low. One of them has to do with our sheriff and the agency in which he represents and the work that they do, which is extraordinary. But on the other side of it, it's also the amenities that this city has continued to build on for many years. And so it's certainly how we fund those projects, when we fund those projects, when we can find additional resources to find those dollars to partner with and make them go longer. So those are some of the things that I'm trying to think long-term, what makes sense for us and how we fund those. So I do particularly have an interest in the process, as well as what we're considering today and what we're approving today, and certainly to that point, COVID didn't help any of these conversations throughout. So, Council, any other questions or comments? Vice Mayor Clufus.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. My question and comment kind of revolves around prioritization of these projects as well. And I just want to be clear that the prioritization of these projects is tough to actually predict because the impact fees that are recovered are required to stay within that area. That's correct for this as well, right? So we couldn't say that project one is definitively going to be the first project that these dollars could impact because of where they're collected from. And just explaining my thought process, I thought that continued communication about the prioritization of which projects were going to come before which would help clarify things for individuals who had questions and looking back at our plan to move forward. But can we just confirm that the dollars that are collected have to stay within that area so we can't fund one thing that's all the way across town by impact fees that are collected on the other side of town?
That's correct. Or they have to be, you know, regional service, regional area for the whole impact fee. And then I'll add one other thing on the difficulty of prediction to add to your comment, Vice Mayor Kloofus, is we saw two projects rise to the surface this year that were not initially the highest of priority, and that was directly related to both had tremendous grant opportunities that came to us. So as directed by council, always looking at how we maximize leverage of those dollars for the benefit of the entire community and those that pay those impact fees will sometimes necessitate a change in priority just so we can make best use of the funds.
Understood. Thank you.
Mayor, I want to follow, if I may, follow up on what the Vice Mayor just indicated, and he's exactly correct, and that is that because, again, these are impact fees, we have, in the study that is the basis for your action today, you know, looks at the list of projects that were recently reviewed by this council a couple years ago, but looks at those that list given the impact of growth. It's not, and you can't look at the expenditure of these impact fees without looking what's causing the need for these particular projects. It has to be that relationship with the growth causing the need for these capital improvements.
And can you speak, Matt, to one of the points or questions about, you know, the initial park project plan, and it was developed to go out to that year end of 30 to 40 years, and why that is viewed that way, in particular in Parks and Rec?
So I wasn't here, obviously, for this plan, but in theory, when you're developing these longer-term plans, again, you're watching growth patterns, you're assessing growth patterns, population distribution, you're assessing the efficacy and success of the different programs or parks or things that you have in place. So you're constantly, as to Bill's point, assessing, you know, these years out or this year's out. Often when you're developing a very complex capital strategy, those can also be lengthened in certain areas for to account for the nature of incoming funding. So if we're looking at doing projects and we're relying on nexus of new improvements or this rational, we keep talking about use that drives it, you may be waiting a certain period of time to fund, to program, design, and then fund that, you know, a specific project. I think for more specifics of why the council at that point chose a longer range than a typical 10 or 20 year, you know, capital facilities plan, that might be a great question for Carl, who just has that relevant experience that I don't have.
Carl, did you want to take that?
Yeah, I can expand on it slightly. And part of it was looking at the overall comprehensive plan. I mean, we talked about the fire because you're looking at long term. So we knew what we had in place at the time when the study was done in terms of amenities or park and rec, you know, facilities for the city. And being a master plan community, we kind of knew the geography, the limitations of where the needs were going to be as we continue to develop these undeveloped lots and where, you know, we would continue to grow as a city. So, you know, through that study, a lot of public input, the determinations were made in terms of how many parks you would need. You know, again, we weren't getting into the programming of, you know, we need 8 softball fields and 20 soccer fields. You know, this doesn't get into that level of detail. It's more of, okay, we have, right now we have 2 parks. Okay, well, to serve the needs of a population that's going to be 4 times this size, is where's the population going to be? What's the travel distance normally, you know, that would be for a neighborhood park or a regional park or a community center. You know, having one center in the center of the communities that can be big enough for our population growth in the future. So it had to look at the ultimate build out of the city to kind of situate, do we need, you know, a north, south, east, and west location for centers? Do we need, you know, how many regional parks do we need to serve our ultimate population growth? And then, you know, as we get closer to programming and developing those actual sites, and that's when you get into the programming and reach out to the public and, you know, what is the public wants and desire at that time, and that gets rolled into the design and programming of that particular project.
And when do we budget for these new projects? The operational costs are always part of the consideration when we're approving those. We know what type of staffing resources are going to be required to maintain the facilities, as well as the cost of the ongoing maintenance of equipment, correct?
I think we're getting better at that as a city. I know we're having very robust conversations about when new subdivisions come, new streets are, you know, are extended, or new right-of-way improvements, for instance, had very robust discussions around Old Kings Road, and what does that look like now with expanded medians or a different type of landscaping? So traditionally, city did a decent job of that, but we are, by council's direction and questions, focusing more on, as you've noticed in certain staff reports at the council workshop when it was presented by Danny Ashburn on the generators, we're asking staff to say, one-time cost is one time. There's a one-time cost to everything, but what are the fixed M&O costs? What is the ongoing life cycle cost? So we can better inform council those decisions. So you will start to see in coming years, how do we account for, when we do put a new park online, Matt Mansell has to figure out a calculation of how much staff it takes, what's the staff hours, what's the equipment cost. To your point, those go on forever, and we need to be accounting for those.
And I think it takes a lengthy amount of time to build a park, construct a park, renovate a park, add additions to the park. There's a lot that goes into those conversations. So I know some of these facilities have been multi-year projects, have been funded in multi-year budgets, and certainly when those conversations come to be, that's when we start making decisions based on that fiscal year. How are we going to plug that into an ongoing basis?
An excellent example of that, Mayor, is Indian Trail Sports Complex, where we saw not just a rehabilitation, but a partial conversion of fields to a more intense and higher use through Little League this year. So correct, absolutely. It's not just the renovation of the programming, but being adaptive to those changes at times, to Carl's point, that drive the actual programming as the community, you know, community grows.
Council, any additional comments? And I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Roll call, please.
Vice Mayor Clufus?
Aye.
Councilmember Branquino?
Aye.
Councilmember Cuff?
Aye.
Councilmember Howell?
No.
Mayor Holland?
Yes.
Mayor, this motion passes 4-1.
We'll now move to agenda item number I-6, which is a resolution, the state revolving fund loan application for engineering design services for the expansion of wastewater treatment plant 2.
Thank you, Mayor, City Council, and we have Steve Flanagan and our consultant here to, this was at the workshop, but to answer any questions or be available.
Council, are there any questions or comments on this agenda item? And I have none. We'll now open it up to the public. Any member of the public wish to make public comment on agenda item number I-6, please call in at 386-223-1690. Thank you, Doug. I'll close public comment. I'll take it back to this council and entertain a motion.
I'll make that motion.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Vice Mayor Clufus?
Yes.
Councilmember Branquino?
Yes.
Councilmember Cuff?
Yes.
Councilmember Howell?
Yes.
Mayor Holland?
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0.
We'll Okay, we'll now move to agenda item number I-7 is a resolution for City Council Strategic Action Plan, additional priorities for fiscal year 2020-2021. Denise, thank you so much for hanging out with us all the morning. I appreciate it. Matt, did you want to open this agenda?
Very simply, Mayor, I was just going to introduce Denise Bevan. I know we have a presentation today to go through the final summation of the Strategic Action Plan to present, I believe, this morning information on how we're going to go about starting the process of identifying and establishing a level of service and some of the new reporting metrics. Am I correct that's going to be discussed a little bit today? So with that, Denise, thank you very much.
Thank you. Once again, Denise Bevan, City Administration Coordinator. I have slides here, first talking about the evaluation steps that we have conducted up to this point. This is a brief summary of the most recent steps taken. But I would like to also reflect that we started this process with the National Citizen Survey results at the beginning of the year. And to Mr. Morton's point, I also want to just touch on some of the steps that will be happening after Council's consideration of adoption today. So today we're here to discuss any additional refinements that should be applied to what we call Exhibit A, which is a house to the council priorities and the direction given to date. After today's presentation and, of course, your consideration of adoption, we will be rolling up our sleeves and getting hard to work on timelines, resource needs, and a lot of that is underway. In preparation of those next steps, to Mr. Morton's point of level of service, delivering that message back to council before budget gets adopted, we do plan to come back to you July 14th with those deliverables for your consideration and to help you move through the budget process as we near the adoption at the end of September. So we did, of course, receive some very good guidance from Council, and we applied that feedback to the areas that we understood from last workshop. And the next two slides are really to showcase those changes. So I'll just start with the clarification for the Innovation District, and we did remove one of the proposed priorities in the service delivery and efficiency focus areas. Added or updated, we heard you loud and clear on the level of service and looking at tangible targets of how we can elevate in our business-friendly initiative, and you can see within that point of the quotations, we did apply a narrative to that sentiment that we heard from you. Moving on to the next, where we actually refined what we started specific to FPNL, expanded that to really all of our primary key stakeholders that work with us on numerous projects, and of course want to weave in the importance of these key initiatives and making sure that we're strengthening and maintaining those relationships. And that's our proposed narrative that's in your exhibit. Going on for fiber, we did add an enhanced element to really refine some of the key points that we heard from the workshop, and we have evaluated and confirmed the option to establish an ISP to permit the selling of bandwidth to retail users. And I have one additional slide that will provide any additional updates to the exhibit, but I would like to pause here for any feedback.
Council, any feedback at this time?
No additional at this time.
Regarding street maintenance, we heard from Council that we need to develop alternative options to traditional funding. So this is a all-encompassing priority that also talks about the need to look at what's currently budgeted and the need for future years. Street maintenance, we also heard appreciation of how we approached our maintenance program and making sure that we keep our eyes wide open on other innovative assessment methods. So there was an addition of that last bullet from the direction we heard at the last workshop. Excuse me, my
throat's a little dry.
I understand the masks.
So just want to pause on those amendments that were adjusted for the direction given by council.
Council, any
no additional
thoughts?
Requirements at this time.
Seeing none, okay.
And with that, I'm just here to answer any additional questions you may have about next steps or how to adjust the resolution if needed prior to your consideration of adoption.
Council, any questions for Denise about the topics you discussed at this time? I will now open up to the public. Any member of the public wish to make public comment on agenda item number I-7. Please do so by calling in at 386-223-1690. Okay, thank you. I will close public comment. Just take it back to this council. Denise, thank you so much. I mean, again, you always are just unbelievably impressive throughout this whole process. You're extraordinarily patient. And you're very intuitive on really our contribution and interview process and public dialogue about this. So thank you very much. This is one of the key things that this council does, I believe, that helps drive and allows staff to have clear direction on what they're, you know, to be sort of focusing on throughout the year. So thank you. I will entertain a motion on this resolution.
I'll make that motion.
I'll second it.
Moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Vice Mayor Clufus?
Affirmative.
Councilmember Branquino?
Yes.
Councilmember Cuff?
Yes.
Councilmember Howell?
Yes.
Mayor Holland?
Yes.
Mayor, this motion passes 5-0.
Thank you.
Mayor, may I interrupt? I'm sorry. Should I propose at this point? I know we've lost a couple people who are signaling me. For a break for a restroom. We've been at it for 3 hours, and I think we probably have a decent amount to go. Would you like to go to a time certain, or would you like to recess for a break at this moment?
Other than this one, all we have is a consent agenda.
Are you feeling comfortable? Okay. Council's feeling comfortable.
Thinking about another 15
thought I would bring it up.
Almost.
Okay. Sorry.
I don't know. What do you think, mate?
I'm good.
Okay.
I think, I, you know, again, I don't see these items as being terribly lengthy.
Okay.
So.
No, I don't know the opinion of any other one of the council people. Maybe.
Okay.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council.
All right. We'll now move to agenda item number 8. It was a resolution approval of the E-section canal improvements.
Thank you, Honorable City Council. This is coming back from a workshop on the discussion. We had three items, if you remember, in tandem talking about E-section canal improvements. And we do have Mike Peel here today if you had any further questions or needed more information.
Councilor, are there any comments or questions for Mr. Peel at this time? Any member of the public wish to make public comment on agenda item number I-8, please do so by calling in at 386-223-1690. Seeing none, I'll close public comment. I will take it back to this council and entertain a motion on this resolution.
I'll make that motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Roll call, please.
Vice Mayor Clufus?
Aye.
Councilmember Branquino?
Yes.
Councilmember Cuff?
Yes.
Councilmember Howell?
Yes.
Mayor Holland?
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0.
Okay. Any member of the public wish to make public comment on the consent agenda items, either 9, 10, 11, 12, or 13, please do so by calling in at 386-223-1690. No public comment. I'll take it back to this council. Entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda as read.
I'll make that motion to approve the consent agenda as read.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Vice Mayor Clufus?
Aye.
Councilmember Branquino?
Yes.
Councilmember Cuff?
Yes.
Councilmember Howell?
Yes.
Mayor Cohen?
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0.
We'll now move to agenda item number K, which is public participation. Any member of the public wish to make public comment on items not on the agenda, now is your time to do so. I'd ask you to please call in at 386-223-1690, and please hit the *9 to raise your hand to provide your comments. Thank you, Doug. We'll now close public comment. I will take it back to the council. Discussion by City Council of matters not on the agenda. I always start with who's right in the room. So, Councilmember Branquino, you are up first.
Thank you. Just very little. When I met with the fire department the other day, not just I was very happy at the way they actually take care of their family. When I mean take care, it's like the way they talk about their families. It's like the fire department, it's a family more than anything else, and a family in a good sense. I talk out of him that their main thing, it's not themselves, it's the people, it's us. That made me very, very proud of him. And the humbleness of this chief and the fire chief show me that they really, really care for this city. And that's probably the most important, sometimes even more than knowledge about what they're doing, which, by the way, they're very knowledgeable, okay? It's the way they care for it, okay? It's very, very impressive. And as to the other thing, I don't know if we should take the first step, but maybe either our city manager or our Councilman Howell, that really should, you know, maybe we could help, and with all due fairness, help Colonel Howell to help go after those companies that we lost because of this. Maybe there's other things that we don't know and that he found out. Maybe if he shares that knowledge with us, I think it's just fair to help, if possible, and if Jack Howell to go after those companies in a good sense. Maybe we all together could do that. Okay.
Does that conclude your comments? Eddie,
that's my comment.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
I'm sorry. I usually look at you. If I turn around, that's
okay.
It.
Okay. Okay. Vice Mayor Klupas.
Thank you very much. First, I would concur with Councilmember Albrecchino that the fire department is almost selfless with the way that they are self-critical and perform analyses of their current workflow and their current achievable goals, and I can only second the emotions that you felt for our fire department and the safety of everyone in our community. And again, I would also encourage Councilmember Howell to engage our city leaders and our city management so that we can have a coordinated attack to go after a potential company of 250 people with $60,000 a year average jobs. I think that's a great thing, and we should actively be reaching out to those type of businesses that are interested in coming to Palm Coast. Third, I'd also just like to thank everyone on staff who's keeping an eye on our COVID numbers. I understand the situation is constantly developing and it's dynamic. So thank you for the continual updates, and I hope that we can continue to get through this safely. And fingers crossed, but I appreciate all the work that everyone's doing and the great job you're doing working remotely and getting back into the office. So thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Cuff.
Yes, I just want to not be the cranky resident old person on the council, but to thank our public safety people and city staff for what they're doing to continue to reopen safely. The medical people I speak to, the stories that I read, I think a lot of our citizens are under the mistaken impression that the war is over, we won, and just go out and do whatever you want to do. In fact, from what I have seen, we are not even past the first wave of the virus infection, so we need to remain vigilant. We need to be creative. I know that, you know, we're looking at other ways of getting meaningful data to help us protect the citizens and our businesses here in the community. But a lot of it still boils down to responsibility of the individual citizens, residents, business owners, and visitors. So please be safe. Please stay healthy. And thank you to the folks that are helping us do that.
Thank you so much. Councilmember Howell.
Yeah, I have nothing.
Okay, thank you. And I will just tackle on to the comments again. Councilmember Cuff, I'm in complete agreement. We've been very fortunate in our community, and I contribute a lot of our success to our residents that really have partnered with us and taken this very serious event seriously and have continued to do so. So I know our response team continues to manage this and continue to find strategies to reopen safely and do it in a manner that has the least impact to our residents overall. So I'm encouraged by the collaborative framework that we have going on, not only throughout our county collectively, but throughout the state, and then working with the Department of Emergency Management and the Governor's Office as well. So we must continue to be diligent. We must continue to heed the advice from the medical professionals and our first responders to continue to drive these numbers in a way that's not going to compromise our residents' health. And I concur with my fellow colleagues. Most times in communities, companies reach out to mayors automatically in an effort to support these initiatives for job creation, job growth. I know I've met with several companies over my term in office, whether it be through economic development or through the chamber or through just companies themselves that have reached out. So I'm always open to doing that. I do it often, and I'm willing to step up and certainly partner with each elected official in an effort to grow jobs here locally. So any support, we can lend, we're here to stand together, and we look forward to this moment. And that concludes my comments. So, Mr. Reichman,
nothing
else? We had you for three today.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yes, okay. City Manager Matt Morton.
Almost got elevated.
Sorry.
Almost got a promotion. Yes, thank you, Mayor, City Council, very briefly. Just mention a couple of things. We're still making progress. I know there's a lot of questions and information, and I think it represents a significant opportunity, and I hope to bring forward information on testing our wastewater for COVID-19. As was mentioned by more than one person today, we're still very much in the middle of this. This is not, in fact, it has not gone away. It is staying very significant and will be here, and this would add yet another tool in our arsenal to be proactive with our community. So I appreciate the leadership, Mayor Holland, Vice Mayor Klufis on this council. Hope to bring that back, and I think it's, again, just a great tool that we can be unique and proactive in caring for the health and safety of our community. Town hall tomorrow, so not too late. Please submit questions. Again, I continue to be amazed. I think the last one, if I remember Tyler telling me, had almost 30,000 engagements, so it just continues to grow as people really appreciate that, and I've appreciated the engagement, as I know everyone has, and the great questions and an opportunity to dialogue with our community. And then lastly, as in the agenda, in my duty to report, we have sole source and emergency purchases that come before the council. We have three that are unique that I'll just mention for your attention. One is Flagler Broadcasting, the COVID-19 communications we have done. We do hope, and hopefully Helena will nod along, we do believe and hope that will be reimbursable. Yes, either under CARES Act or the FEMA ultimate reimbursement, but that is a significant expense that was unbudgeted. We also similarly have, if you notice, the Grace Community Food Pantry. That is the continuing use of the donations we received, over $100,000 under the Feed Palm Coast Initiative, Mayor Holland. And so that was a commitment. Those funds will be and are only used for supporting what they were collected for, which is the food drives in the community. So you'll notice that purchase if you're wondering. And then lastly, there under sole source provisions, there is a sole source for Kootenai law for specific expertise that was selected in both labor law and labor investigations related to personnel matters because of some any future requests or ongoing requests on an unneeded basis. And this was done to ensure transparency, continuity, and availability of our fraud, waste, and abuse hotline and system. Through our process, we learned that we have some significant flaws in that process, and as is any best practice in an agency, when you're looking at your own practices, especially in relationship to investigations or personnel, you go outside and you pick a neutral, independent party to assist you, and so that's what was done in that instance. This will not be permanent. This is a temporary sole source as we get through the changes and recommendations of fixing our process. So those are the three highlights of sole source. If there's any specific questions, myself or staff could answer those.
I'll make a motion, but how are you going to gavel it down?
Oh, we're done.
Now, I just want to add, to that expenditure around, continuing to feed the community. Feed Palm Coast began with an initiative to partner with the faith-based community. The faith-based community drove the volunteers as well as the organization partnered with the City of Palm Coast for the logistics communication resources for a contribution aspect of this. So both food were contributed for the day of the event in an enormous way, and the monetary contributions. What we didn't spend for that day's event, we have agreed with the faith-based community to spend on an ongoing basis. So this continues to feed our community. These weekly food drives have continued to go on through the COVID response in an effort to help alleviate some of the stress that our families are currently facing due to unemployment, due to the fact of higher stress with the children being out of school and additional impact on their daily lives. And so I'm very proud of our community, but I'm also very proud of our faith-based community that continue to drive and be an extraordinary partner that care tremendously around our residents. So I applaud everyone involved.
Okay. Can I make
motion
that motion
to adjourn?
Now?
Yes. Okay.